Hello, you're listening to Talk with Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
And today's episode is our Spring 2021 Anime Season Reviews Part 2. We have a load of titles to go through, including Pretty Boy Detective Club, Dragon Ghost House Hunting, Fruits Basket, the final. It's finally over. Higehiro, After Being Rejected, I Shaved and Took in a High School Runaway. Let's Make a Mug 2. That's T-O-O, not number 2, by the way. Combatants Will Be Dispatched. I've been killing slimes for 300 years and maxed out my level. Koikimo, Koikimo, love is disgusting or something like that. I don't remember the full title. Shadow House, So I'm a Spider, So What? Osamake, rom-com where a childhood friend won't lose. The Slime Diaries and Mini Dragon. As well as if we have some time, we'll go through our thoughts on the series that are still going on, like Tokyo Revengers, To Your Eternity, Welcome to Demon School, Irma-kun 2, and that's still going, right?
It is. It's still going.
Okay. Don't say that like crap. Not going to edit things. And also My Hero Academia Season 5. So cool stuff. You ready?
Ready as I'm ever going to be.
A lot of stuff. So yeah, let's start things off with Pretty Boy Detective Club. Did you finish that one?
No, I actually didn't.
My gosh, Chris, you're a bad person.
Probably.
You're an absolutely bad person. Anyways, this one is Bishonen Tantaiden, or Pretty Boy Detective Club. It streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Shaft. The source is a novel. The genres are comedy, mystery, sci-fi. Of course, the creator and writer of the series, the light novel series, is Nishi Oisin, who is, of course, known for doing the Monogatari series. The director was Akiyuki Shinbo, who did March Comes on Like a Lion, Arakawa Under the Bridge, and the Monogatari series. And the character designer was Kanako, who, of course, is known for doing Gatchaman Crowds. So, good stuff there. This one opens up with a girl named Mayumi Dojima, and Mayumi is currently looking up at the stars, and at some point, a boy named Manabu Satoin decides to confront her and tell her that he pretty much can solve her problems and to come with her to the Pretty Boy Detective Club, which is in the art club, and when she arrives there, kind of on the way there, she's kind of mentioned the idea that there is this kind of rumor about this Pretty Boy Detective Club that is this group of boys that will, like, solve problems for people, but it's always like under the tinge that they won't say anything about what transpired. It's like a secrecy or like a, you know, a do not disclose what happened kind of thing. And there's like this little whisper about whatever they solve usually ends up becoming a bigger problem in the end. But she arrives there and immediately she kind of tells them her issue, which is that she, several years prior on her birthday, she's seen a star up in the sky and it kind of inspired her to, you know, go into, you know, astrology kind of stuff or astronomy kind of stuff. And she's never seen that star since that day. And she wants to find that star because that was her inspiration. And if she doesn't find it, she's kind of got to give up on her dreams that she wanted to do. So, yeah, they take up the job like, yeah, sure, we'll find this star for you. And they start kind of investigating it. And it kind of gives you an opening to kind of get to know these characters. The entire club is, of course, always filled with pretty boys. There's the three roles. They have to be pretty, they have to be a boy, and they have to be a detective, obviously, you know, hence the title. And so this group of, there's Manabu, who is the main leader of them, and he's kind of like this very, very obsessed with aesthetic kind of person. Everything's got to be, you know, beautiful. There's Michiru, who's like the more delinquent character and obviously kind of is a very good cook, I guess, is the other attribute to him. Hyota, who is like the little leg boy, super athletic, has these very beautiful legs. Sosaku, who is kind of more the artsy person, doesn't really talk much. And then finally, the last one, which I don't have on my screen, so I have to scroll. There's like a weird thing up on the screen. Nagahira, who is the like very well spoken ones, very good at speakings, the student council president, all that kind of stuff. So together with all them, they kind of go out and they solve this mystery. Really quickly, after this first kind of arc, there's like about four different arcs to the series. After this first arc, they kind of start pulling her into the club, and she starts becoming a part of their club, and she helps them with, or at least is a part of their group as they go out and solve different mysteries. And that's kind of the gist of it. A lot of the focus is, you know, the every different job they take on and what they have to kind of solve and the craziness that happens with that. So yeah, I think the initial thing is do not take this as your typical pretty boy show. This is Nisioisen. He does typically a lot of, you know, harem type shows where he kind of tears it apart. Well, not necessarily, because like Katana Katari wasn't really a harem show. He just takes usual archetypes and really kind of messes with them. And that was kind of what I was looking for when I came into the series, was like, okay, what is he going to do to this harem? Which is basically a reverse harem. And that was my real initial pull. Was like, okay, I know Nisioisen is a really good writer. And I know with like the Monogatari series, he had archetypes. They were all, you know, tsunderes and donderes and all that kind of stuff. But he would just kind of mess with them and destroy them in a sense as he makes his storytelling. And unfortunately, I didn't really find that with this. I didn't see him really mess with these characters. I mean, Nagahiro, they got into a little bit with him and his relationship with Kodaki, who is this, they always call him the lolicon because he's engaged to a younger girl. And so everybody calls him the lolicon guy. And they technically get into him and why he is, you know, set to be wed to this girl. And essentially the conflicts that creates for him and what his almost like the issues with the arranged marriage that he has. And that's about really it. I mean, they did a little bit with Manabu and this whole aspect of having to grow up. But other than that, he didn't really mess with the archetypes like he did with the Monogatari series. Now, granted, this is 12 episodes and we had literally tons of episodes to deal with the Monogatari series to really start diving into them. And if you think about it, technically with the early season of Monogatari series, it doesn't really get super into that stuff. It's not until you like go further and further into, well, we're at like 150 episodes of the Monogatari series now.
Your guess is as good as mine.
So I guess it could just be a factor of it just not being there yet with the novel adaptation. So far, maybe it just seems like it's more so focused on the introductions, which seems to be the case because there's so many characters, and with every arc, they're introducing new characters, and they technically just leave them in behind after they're done. So it's like they have an arc where they get into this art teacher, Towai. Towai enters the picture at the very end of that arc, and I'm going, oh, cool, this Towai chick just reminds me of like these more, you know, sinister characters that would be in the Monogatari series that I want to know more. You got me, let me see more. And then literally, next episode, they're gone. You don't see him ever again. Lai was one of the characters that showed up, and he was like this very business and con-related type student that ran this casino in the dark. And they kind of brought him back into the picture with a later arc. But overall, most of these characters, Ray, who's with the 20s, they introduce him and then they just disappear. And that's like the unfortunate thing is like I'm liking what you're doing, and then you kind of do a reset with the next detective story that you're doing. The only kind of thing that continues to, I guess, progress is Dojima and her place as a part of the Pretty Boy Detective Club. So it's a thing of like, I just don't know if it's just not there yet, or, and we're just doing introductions, or if this is it. This is all he's really going to do with these characters. And that's the struggle that I have. It's like, he's still a great writer. Like, the dialogue and everything is still there. Like, the usual Monogatari series back and forth conversations is still there. And unfortunately, it didn't really it didn't really hit me until they had this encounter with the 20s, which is this like secret organization that does really shady jobs, like a mercenary group that does criminal activities. Until they got this conversation between Ray of that group and Satoin, who is the president of the group, that I was like, okay, this is the writing that I remember. This is this dialogue exchange that I absolutely love in his work. It's just unfortunate that it took a little bit of time to get to that. And after that, it was really kind of driven through the comfortableness that Dojima has with the group. Once she gets comfortable, and then suddenly her character comes out, she literally becomes the liveliness of the show because everybody else is just their archetypes, and so they kind of stick with that. Whereas she's more animated and more combative with them, to almost like a counter tease in everything that she does. So yeah, I still love it. It's still entertaining. It still has a nice artistic style to it. It's still Shaft, so they don't do the crazy stuff like Monotari where they do crazy text on the screen all the time. It's more artistic choices for certain things. Like every time they are presented with an issue, they'll at some point have a gathering where each one of them will give their theory on what happened. Like, okay, so this thing appeared here. Why did it appear here? Everybody gathers and gives their idea of how it got there. And whenever it does that, each time they did that with each case, it would change the styling of their presentation of it. So one time when they were talking to about Kodaki and how this sculpture appeared, it did like a really old style Japanese painting style to it, to the characters and how it portrayed what was happening, which I thought was cool. So it still has like Shaft doing their own little unique thing in there, which I'm assuming is not in the novel. I don't know how they would put it in the novel unless it's just artwork that's on a page. But yeah, still good dialogue, still great character exchanges and chemistry. Disappointed that they didn't really do much with any of the boys, except for, like I said, Manabu, which they, like I said, they got into a thing about how there's a hierarchy system in the school. A lot of it's driven by the student council president and their desire to kind of keep things unrestricted so that when he's actually not in this school, he's actually in like middle school. So he hasn't really gotten to that school yet. And so they want to make it sure it's preserved so that when he does arrive there, he can still do what he's doing, which is having fun and doing this detective stuff. But there's this attitude of like, you know, should you just move on and grow up kind of thing? Like what you're doing and being, you know, uskashi and over bombastic and silly and having these little fun little adventures, should you stop? Because it's technically child's play kind of thing. So yeah. Still solid in them, though. I enjoyed it. It was still very entertaining. But yeah, that's Pretty Boy Detective Club. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. Moving on, we have Dragon Goes House Hunting, or Dragon A Wo Kau. This one was streamed on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Signal MD. The source is a manga, and the genres are comedy, fantasy, and shonen. And I have no clue. I didn't write any synopsis stuff down this because I didn't watch it, so you're going to have to synopsis it.
The Leti is a red dragon. He's supposed to be protecting an egg. He fails to protect it from basically treasure hunters. They came and stole the egg and took it away. That made his father mad at him, and his father kicked him out of the house forever, exiling him. So he goes in search of a house or a place to be. He goes to like the human towns, he goes to the dwarf town, and pretty much everybody hates him because he's a dragon. He ends up bumping into the demon lord, who this demon lord didn't want to be the demon lord, but was kind of just foisted on him. And he just went and disappeared. And everybody's been looking for the demon lord for thousands of years, never have found him. They end up bumping into each other, and Leti tells the demon lord that he wants a home. The demon lord says, "Not a problem. Here's my card." Shows him his card, and they go house hunting. And that's pretty much the gist of the show. Is that every episode or half an episode, they go to a new place. The demon lord pretty much tells him all the benefits of being in this place, and then the kind of the latter half of the episode, Letty ends up finding out all the negatives about it. And that's pretty much the gist of the show. That's how it works. Pretty much every episode, new place, goods and the bads, and then move on to the next episode. There was one character that was in the intro that I was really hoping to see, and she did not show up until literally the last couple of episodes. So I'm going to have to say I'm very, very disappointed in the show. It was fun. I liked the general.
There's this cute girl in the intro that I was expecting, and she didn't show it until late, so I didn't really enjoy it that much.
Well, the reason why I say that is because, like I said, it's a disappointing show. It has a lot of potential. The concept, if you think about it, is Dragon is hunting or is looking for a place to be. And then, like I said before, and I think the first impressions I was talking about, what's kind of funny about this show is it's literally taking RPG tropes and trying to explain them. So, like I said, when we were talking about it, was Letty in his scales, he's holding one of his baby teeth, which by all accounts doesn't make any sense why a dragon would have a baby tooth unless he's hiding it somewhere, because it's a full-grown dragon. Why does he have a dragon's baby tooth? Well, that explains it. He hides it in his scales. I think they at some point they talk about some gold that Letty has. Well, where does a dragon hold his gold? So things like that. It does toy with a lot of those tropes and tries to explain them the best way that they can. Why do humans end up in the shrine after they died? Well, the demon lord sends them there. So it tries to play with a lot of that kind of stuff. And in that case, it does do really well. The problem is like I said, there's what I didn't say is the biggest stain of this show is literally Letty himself. He is literally probably the one thing that I kind of wish was gone, but that would take away the whole premise of the show. Is mm-hmm. The dragon is he's.
You're all excited because Kendra Suda showed up, and you're thinking Kendra Suda was going to replace him.
He might save the game, the show. And that's the reason why I held out so much hope on the girl in the intro, because, and she did, she lightened the show up so much, but literally she's only there for like the last three episodes. So it's kind of frustrating to lean on one character to save a show. The Demon Lord was cool. I liked him. He kind of, because of how OP he was, when Letty would get into some kind of bad situation, the Demon Lord just blow everybody away and it's problem solved. But the Pichon was kind of fun. I liked a lot of that interplay, but unfortunately he wasn't enough to save it. I don't want to be too negative on the show. It was fun. Like I said, there is some cool stuff in there. If you want to dig into RPG tropes and get kind of a smile here and there, it works really well. But don't take my word for it. The humor didn't work for me. Doesn't necessarily mean it won't work for you.
I think when we were doing the first impressions, I think I presented the idea of, do you think we at this point have kind of done the RPG trope thing like enough? Like we've had enough adaptations of shows that take those RPG tropes and jokes with them, and it's like at some point we're running out of material. I think it was a show that we had a couple seasons ago that I had mentioned that on it with. It's like I don't know that we need to do this anymore. Like these jokes have been done to death. Do we really need to keep going? Oh, by the way, level, get it? So funny, right?
Well, even like
I think it was a Spider. I think Spider really did kill me. Like when we were doing So Spider So What in that early segment, and she's leveling up and it's laughing about her getting skills and all the information flying up on the screen, and I'm like, not to say that this is copying Slime, but do we really need to do this again?
I don't know, because the same argument could be made for the bikini armor show that came on a season ago. I think that we kind of just skipped over that because it really wasn't doing anything. The second season,
like 3 years ago, Chris.
No. I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the one that was here a season or two ago, and they just released a second season on it. I went and caught up on the first season. The first season was hilarious. Second season, boring as all get out. Not because they were doing it, was mostly because I think they had just overtreaded the bikini joke. And yes, I know there's the bikini armor one that where the three ladies who were going through the houses and mm-hmm. took, that's not the one I'm talking about. I'm talking about the one, the bikini armor shop that was a season or two ago. Anyway, that one, the first season was hilarious. The second season, they even extended the episode and did a whole entire...
No, that was the one where they posted it later than the actual season.
Right.
That's what it was.
And
it
then they...
It wasn't that it was in that season.
And then they added the second season that season. So, I just watched it. I'm sorry. The problem was is that literally, like I said, the first season was hilarious. The second season, it was retreading the entire thing, and they added this entire weird thing where they were doing this kind of going into a movie version, and they were doing some kind of weird find the remote control, and it was like, okay, this is just dumb. That's almost a waste of half of the episode. The first half of the episode, you're hurting for material. So, like I said, maybe you're right that the RPG tropes have been kind of overdone, but I seriously don't think so, because even Dragon Goes House Hunting, they're doing some cool things, but the humor just wasn't hitting very well.
But you don't think the humor is not hitting well is because it's technically not something you need to see again?
Well, like I said, it was doing different things. Building a entire dungeon and explaining why it's working the way it's working kind of makes sense. Some groups maybe have done the where do you get the hero armor. I can't think of a show that I've seen that in, except for a light novel that I've recently read that tries to explain it. I haven't actually seen a show that's covered that.
Where the mechanics themselves,
right? Where the heroes go in, they challenge the boss. Why is there a boss there? Well, the bosses are there to protect the house when the demon lord or the dragon in this case is not there. The dragon hires the bosses, and they have reasons for doing what they're doing. So in some cases it makes sense. Other cases it doesn't make sense. Why is gnomes only in the forest area? Well, because gnomes live in the forest, and this is a forest dungeon. Well, the demon lord brings slimes in, says that it's protected it from these people for this reason, and then explains why it's doing that. I've not seen a show that's actually explained the dungeons and why they are the way they are.
Dragon Goes House Hunting. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. Fruits Basket, the final. It's finally here. This is streaming on pretty much every platform. Ran for 13 episodes, and it does have a sequel arc adaptation that has been announced already. Not really a sequel arc. It's apparently, according to some people that I've read, they skipped Taru Honda's parent story in the manga. And since, like we mentioned before, the whole idea of this adaptation is they're going to adapt everything. Sure enough, that arc will be adapted, and they're going to apparently do it as its own separate special. So I don't know that they've announced if it's going to be a TV or if it's going to be a movie or if it's going to be an OVA, but it's coming. So there's still more coming. It's just apparently an arc that was somewhere in the manga that they just completely skipped in this adaptation, which did surprise me because I thought this was going to be a two-core.
Yeah.
So, like 2 weeks out. No, literally, I think it was like that they released the 12th episode already. And I found out, and I'm like, okay, I got to rush through all this to get it caught up. Which is a terrible thing to do with Fruits Basket, because it's extremely traumatizing to watch. And very depressing to watch in a binge. But got through it, so it's fine. But that would make sense. I mean, I wonder if they just purposely chose to get that story out there so that they could just wrap it up in a core. But Yeah, studio is TMS Entertainment. They source the manga, like I mentioned before. And the genres are slice of life, comedy, romance, drama, fantasy, shoujo. And yes, I guess to give people a brief idea of what Fruits Basket is, it essentially is a series that follows a girl named Toru Honda, who eventually bumps into the Soma family. And the Soma family is essentially a group of family members that all kind of a bloodline of kind of a something that happened in the past in this kind of mythology. And each one of the Soma family members, certain Soma family members are actually possessed by members of the Zodiac. And when they are possessed with a member of the Zodiac, they are then tied into an individual. And even though in the earlier seasons, we were kind of trying to figure out what this particular curse is that essentially keeps them bound to this one person, we also kind of see the damages that that kind of causes, the almost unwanted connection that they have with a certain person. And of course, we end up finding out over time that this certain one person is an extremely terrible person, an extremely terrible human being. And that's kind of the focus of it, is really Toru, who is brought into this kind of situation, and her outlook on life that's always seemingly positive. She always has a very positive nature to herself, and her ability to really kind of pull these individuals out of the darkness that they're really in is a key feature of this. But it's not that she doesn't have her own problems, which you'll find as well, and like what her relationship with her mother and all the things that she's gone through, also the friends and family that she has around her that she's had experiences with, is really the main key focus of the entirety of the series. And as we get into the final, and this is where we'll get soft spoilers here. I'm not saying that we're going to go into individual things that spoil the series as a whole. None of that. Just really kind of, I guess if you mention certain characters and what they're going through, it does kind of lead some speculations. But yeah, as we get into the season, a lot of the focus really darts in on Akito, who is this person that is in the center of the Soma family. How they're bound to Akito, how they can break this, again, curse, quote-unquote curse, that is placed upon them, that is really kind of forcing them to have to be a part of Akito's life. And what that means if they could possibly break that curse. What does it mean for their futures? Can they have the relationships that they want to have? And the almost emptiness that they feel when they break that bond that they have. So yeah, what's your thoughts on Fruits Basket, the final?
I am happy that I got closure on the show. I really am.
Literally should be the title. It should be Fruits Basket, the conclusions.
Yeah, it is nice to have a completion to the story, because it's one of those shows that watching the first release of it several years ago, I did really, really love a lot of the characters in the story. And getting kind of more in depth in a lot of them and digging into kind of the meat of the character interactions and why they are the way they are and all that stuff was really satisfying to get all of that. This particular season was, I'm not going to say it was a slog to get through, because the first few episodes were kind of really rough to do. The latter three quarters of the show, it really finally started delving into, like Andrew was mentioning, Akito, which getting kind of the backstory on that particular character was phenomenal. It really brought everything together as this kind of more the backbone of what made this story work in its own way.
Akito or the god?
The Akito and the god kind of inner.
I like the story of the god. I just don't like the story of Akito.
I think that because I do know that when you were mentioning it seemed like it wasn't satisfying for you. It was satisfying for me. It finally made a lot of what was going on make sense.
Oh yeah, it makes sense. I guess to get into my thoughts as a whole for the entire series, my biggest gripe has always been that if you think about it, unfortunately, most of these character stories all basically have the same premise. Their parents are terrible people.
Yeah.
And that's my struggles. I love how this writer builds character. I love how this writer does drama. And I think the directing and the presentation of the adaptation itself really hits the notes every time. Now, granted, you can make an argument that it's always two characters together. It builds up to a climax in their conversation, kick in music really loud, and emotional impact climax to the conversation. That seems to be it feels very cycled. Like it keeps doing the same thing. Conversation, climax, conversation, drama builds up, music hits. But they do it so well. So it's like hard to argue. It's always impactful. It's always grabbing my tears. It's always saying, here, have a stomach punch again. But when I think about it, it's unfortunate when I realize that most all these characters is just terrible parents. And their parents are terrible people. And then when I get into Octo's story, and it's like, oh, yay, another person with terrible parents. Well, a terrible parent. But no, I'm with you. I think that this season was fantastic just because it did so well in concluding all these stories. Like, Fruits Basket has a huge cast. There's so many freaking characters. And we're not even just talking about how the fact that you have pretty much one of every Zodiac. So you have one of each character there. And then you have the center. And then you have Toru. And then you have Toru's friends. And then you have people that are surrounding Toru's friends, her, and the Soma family. It's a lot of characters. We're talking, what, like actual characters that have a story, probably upwards of 40. Maybe
just
30.
Just to take this into consideration, just the Zodiac is 12 characters. The two extras, which would be the cat and the god, that's 14 characters. Then you add on Toru, 15, Toru's friends, two more. And then we're not even talking about the parents yet.
Yeah.
So to take that into consideration when we're talking about there's a lot of characters, that would probably be my biggest beef on this story is the sheer number of characters. I literally, the last episode or two, I pointed out at Andrew, I'm like, who even is this character?
There was only one character that I'm like, yeah, I don't seem to, I think I know who it is, but not really. But yeah, that was really cool because, and it is an unfortunate thing because at some point it feels like at least two characters had like this significant character change, one being growth and one being style. And it doesn't really show that. Like, yeah. It's suddenly out of nowhere, this character is somewhat like seemingly 3 feet taller. And it's like, why? What? What happened?
Now I'm going to chop that up because now that you've mentioned growth that spurt. There's going to be, yeah, I'm going to chop that up to just possibly that arc might have been kind of the buffer for that.
I was expecting like this like, and so summer passed kind of you know, narration that happens, but no, it's just literally scene chains, characters really tall. It's like, what?
Yeah, so that was kind of jarring, but it was I know that particular character was getting to that time frame, so it should have happened sooner or later, but not that fast. But no, in the last one, there was the monk. I think we finally decided on it was the monkey. That character I didn't recognize at all. And then there was another character who was hidden or was hiding behind a wall as a particular conversation was happening. And I don't even know who that is. I still don't know who that is to this day.
See, I thought it was. I was certainly thinking it was Nahito, but I don't think it was him. But no, the Ritsu, yeah, definitely had a huge change. But no, I think the other reason why this season's so refreshing is that I was technically a little bothered by the last season. I thought that they started to spin the wheels. Like, we kept doing this thing where Yuki's getting better, and then suddenly Yuki's depressed again, and then Yuki's finding happiness again, and then Yuki's mad again. And then it's like it's back and forth constantly throughout that entire season. And like I said, it felt like the writing was spinning its wheels and it wasn't going anywhere. And then to have this season where it felt like, yeah, bam, 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 conclusion, conclusion, conclusion. And they were all emotional and fantastic conclusions. Like, even doofball characters, like the one that's obsessed with Yuki, like getting a closure to her character was like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. And I like it. I'll take it. But no, I guess technically the only conclusion that I wasn't really satisfied with was Akito. And it was really a thing of, they spent so much time making you despise this character. Like, even in this season, I was hating this character. And then to have it, like, almost feel like it was too easy. It didn't feel like it was really addressed. It wasn't confronted. And granted, that seems to be the point of the writer, is that, you know, move on. Don't dwell on it. Don't seek revenge. That's where I don't, not that I wanted it to be everybody go over there and murder this character to experience severe punishment, like physical or anything like that. It's just that it felt like it wasn't confronted. But yeah, it's still a fantastic series.
It is one of those frustrating, and even one of the characters even pointed it out at some point, is that particular character was crying and saying, how come you guys can just forgive and move on from this? Yeah. I can't. And that was a fantastic explanation of kind of even more my conflicted feelings about Akito is yes, I do feel like I have to agree with you where that character was kind of let off a little easy.
Right.
But at the same time, that character's...
It is the influence of Toru, obviously. It is the influence of Toru that they act the way they do. And but it's still a little too easy.
But at the same time, I do understand the motivations behind that character a lot more now. And that, to me, that makes it... That character's being brought in make a lot more sense, and how what they were doing and why they were doing it. Does that make up for it? No, it doesn't. It just makes their motivations a little bit more clear, and that is why I liked the way they ended that.
Question for you, and I can make this vague because I'm sure you probably know where I'm going with this. What do you think of the whole issue that Kyo had with the mother? That whole thing, that traumatic experience. I thought that was extremely stupid. I didn't like it. He thought he heard something. I knew that that's where they were going with it, but I'm like, really? We're doing this? Like, what? It was like she was saying something, but only one part came out.
Oh, yeah.
I was dumb. I'm sorry, that was dumb. And it was so washed over, too. It's like, eh.
I don't know. I liked it. I thought that scene was real. It was impactful at the time it was needed. It was frustrating to have to wait as long as I had to wait for that, because I knew it didn't make any sense. Why would that character do that? But it finally pulled in another situation, and I think that it was really placed there because it was necessary to get that other part of the story out of the way.
Yeah, but the unfortunate thing is the whole aspect of what he thinks he heard and how he technically doesn't know what she actually said.
He, in a way, he does, even though it wasn't...
It doesn't imply that.
No, he knows of the promise. Let me put it that way. He knows of the promise, and that was why she said what she said. And that's the problem, is it needed to have that promise, that explanation of that promise, before they could explain why she said what she said.
I just don't know how he gets clarity of that, I guess. I guess it's,
no, no,
it could be
a
thing of moving on and forgetting it, but...
It is a moving on thing. No, you're right. He will never know that's what she was saying. I don't think it matters. It matters.
I think it matters that they chose to do that. I just think it's an unwanted thing. That's my problem. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it was necessary. And it ends up just turning into a really... And that could be a thing of things. Sometimes things are screwed up.
It is. And it really is.
There's no explaining it. This is reality.
That's just like Akito. Like I said before, do I think that it justifies his actions? No, I don't.
Yeah.
But and that you can lay at the feet of just irrationality of people.
Yeah.
And that's why I would say that this writer is so phenomenal at what they do. That everything that was done was nuanced. Seems to be pretty well thought out. I'm not going to say all of it I agree with that people would do what they do, but like Akito in himself, I don't think that every one of their actions
are... I'm going to get mad you're saying Akito, it's Akito.
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 just chop that up to hearing Akito my entire life, okay? Yeah. Just
the art, yeah.
I do understand that the name is Akito. Anyway, not all of that character's thought processes were well thought out, in my opinion. But I think that it's hard for a person to write a character who has an irrational side. That's one of those things that's really, really difficult to portray. I even chop that up to myself is sometimes I try so hard to rationalize a thought process. It makes it really, really hard for me to feel an understanding of a character who is purely irrational. Mm-hmm. That's one of those things that's really frustrating for me. And some of the things that that particular character did not make sense to me. But I'm dragging out stuff that doesn't need to be dragged out.
That would be my issue with Akito as a person and knowing that person is that my thought process is not really trying to figure out rationality. It's my problem is that I give the benefit of the doubt and Akito had walked all over me. If I ever met Akito, Akito would walk all over me because I would constantly think, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, and there's no giving any Akito the benefit of the doubt. It's like the whole issue of like, oh, here, I'm here to visit you, slap. Okay, I'm here for you, slap. Why? Okay, whatever that's for, you want to hang out for, slap. Okay, we're still doing this. I mean, you're probably a little angry, slap. There's got to be a reason why you're in. Slap. It just would be a terrible experience. Can I say the biggest surprise of me this season? I love Maki. Maki was fantastic. Agree, disagree, best girl. I loved the episodes with her were so great. The whole... And it was weird because it was one of those ones where you're like, again... trying to figure out the rationale of it, like why is she doing this, why is she obsessed with stepping on snow, and then this moment where like has that element of perfection that she's upset with, and then Yuki breaks the chalk. I was like, that was like the best scene ever. It was so simple. The chalk goes slide, she gets upset about it, he just reaches over and snaps while he's talking to the group. I was like, you too. Oh, you too. I ship you too.
I liked the way they did a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Great conclusion. I get, if I can give it anything, like Fruit Basket as a whole, I loved it. I thought it was, like I said, it was a great portrayal of emotion, character emotion. Like I said, I have my issues with the fact that a lot of it is just driven by bad parents. You can basically call it Fruit Basket. Parents terrible. But at the same time, she knows how to write characters. She knows how to write trauma that can come into these characters and how just positivity can do so much. Like Toru as a positive person, she's not, you know, going over there and giving somebody food when they need food. She's not going over there and, you know, rewriting their family structure. She's not over there going, hey, you be with this person, you'll be happy. She's literally just there and bringing light. And that, like I said, that's to the credit of Akito's story. But at the same time, it's expressing the idea of just being there with people. Just being positive is a huge thing for some people. And yeah, that if I can give the entire series any credit, it's that. And like I said, in the final season, my thoughts on that, just fantastic conclusion to all the stories.
Yeah, Honda was providing... acceptance, and Akito was demanding loyalty, and that was the main difference in the and why the schism had happened. And I think that was well done when it all came down.
Yep. Fruit Basket, the final, definitely suggests the entire series. Mine and I like the scene with Mine. Like, they're all great. I love it. Too many good moments in that series. Higehiro, after being rejected as Shade and took in a high school runaway, or Hige wo soru shoshite Joshikose wo Hiro. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 13 episodes. The studio was Project Number 9. The source was a light novel. And the series composition was done by Hitomi Ueno, who did Snow White with Red Hair, Amanchu, Flying Witch, and Noragami. Did you finish this one?
No.
No? So you didn't do any of them? Did you get Koikimo?
Mm-mm.
No.
That one was even more... Ah, Chris. This one was the one that I was considering doing.
He asked me which one. I never gave him an answer, apparently, so that's his excuse that he never watched any of them.
No, it was too far into the library, and I didn't want to go digging for it.
Higahiro, this series has the most misleading title ever. The title being After Being Rejected, I Shaved and Took on High School Runaway. What actually happens is it opens up with this guy named Yoshida, who is an office worker, and he is currently on a dinner date with one of his coworkers, Goto, and he really likes Goto, and so he pretty much offers, hey, you want to come back to my place after this? And she's like, nah, sorry, I've been keeping a secret, but I actually have been seeing somebody, so I'm not single. And so that, of course, is pretty bad for him because he's always liked Goto. And so he decides after this dinner to go and get drunk with his friend. And after leaving the pub and he's on his way home, he ends up running into a girl named Sayu, a high schooler who is on the side of the street in the middle of the night. And he's like, hey, girl, go home. I mean, it's dangerous to be out here. And she's like, no, I don't have anywhere to go. Can I stay with you? And he's like, no, heck no, you can't stay at my place. And after her kind of pushing him, he finally goes, okay, you could just stay there for one night and just leave in the morning. And so when they get back to his place, she kind of tries to advance on him, but he doesn't, he kind of ignores it. And then come the next morning, he realizes there's a high schooler in my house. Why is she here? And she, of course, tells him, you ran into me last night and you said I could stay at your place. And what this ended up turning into is a story kind of progresses that you end up finding out through conversations between her and Yoshida is that she's been trying to basically survive on the streets because she doesn't want to go back home. You'll find out later on that her mother is a pretty nasty person. This should have been part of the Fruits Basket story. Where's Tora Honda when you need her? What it kind of turns into is that Sayu doesn't want to return home, and how she survived on the streets was that she would stay with different men. And obviously, what they would end up wanting in return to letting her stay at their places is her body. And after they would get tired of her, they would just, kick her out of their house. And she would go from place to place just having a place to stay by giving up her body. And so, obviously, when she's now staying at Yoshida's place, she thinks that's what he wants in return, and he keeps saying, no, you're a high schooler, you're too young, I'm not interested in you. And what he kind of decides to keep her there is because he doesn't want her to go back to what she's doing. So the conundrum becomes, what he's doing is illegal. You're not supposed to have a high schooler in your home. The idea of even having a minor in your home in Japan is literally instant arrest. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You are arrested. It is just not allowed. And her being there is a safe haven for her, so there is the taboo conundrum. Does he kick her out in order to not get arrested? And her going back to just giving up her body and being abused by men in order to survive? Or does he keep her there, let her get back on her feet, and look forward into her future? And that becomes like a main aspect of the storyline, is that protection of this girl, giving her hope and a future, and not allowing her to go back to where she was before. And again, it's a touchy subject, so it's more difficult than that. And that's really where I'm kind of at with this story, is my difficulty obviously there is, will this be a story that talks about the taboo subject, do it respectfully, and not just turn into a guy bags the high schooler. Now, granted, the ending kind of, there's probably going to be mixed feelings on how that ends, if that was respectful of that notion or not, because that was my whole thing, especially later on when you started kind of seeing Sayu have feelings for Yoshida, like honest feelings, and then him obviously looking at her differently, is like, are we going to do this whole... We open up with, here's a taboo, but he's actually a good guy, so we want to root for him. He's the hero, technically. To, yeah, he bags the high score. Right on, guy. That's the issue. What is it going to do? And like I said, I think many people could probably argue how it ended. I honestly am, I'm kind of a little disappointed with how it ends, but at the same time, it was as a whole technically respectful of what it was doing, which I think was telling this idea of this taboo story, and that you can't just jump to conclusions. I think that was a main key thing, and I ended up getting into with my video review of this, is that I think the coolest thing that you can get from the story is the idea of not assuming all people are bad. There's an issue that we have in society that criminals technically have pushed us to the point that it molds the way we think. So when a person walks by a playground and they smile at seeing a kid playing ball because it's cute, we immediately think predator. We don't just think, hey, this guy thinks this kid was really adorable when he did that. And that's what the issue that we have is that assumption of guilt. And that's essentially what he's going through, is that assumption of guilt. And every time somebody finds out that he has her at his home, what's the first question? You're not doing anything to her, are you? Because that's an obvious thought that we would have. Obviously, the first and foremost thing that you should always consider is the safety of children. There's right. nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. And I'm not saying it's okay that he has her at his home. But it's one of those things of, can you deal with that conflict that you have when you hear her story? Do you have that conflict when you realize, what other options does she have? Where is a better option for her? What is going to happen if he were just to kick her out? She'd probably end up dead. We don't know. And that's the conundrum that it creates. And that's exactly why I love it so much. And that's why I was attached to it so much, is I love these stories that essentially, yes, it's telling a taboo story. And yes, it's an extremely difficult show for me to suggest to anybody just because it's taboo. Like, how do I go, hey, check out Higahiro, and they start watching the first episode. It's like, wait, there's a young girl that's in this guy's house. Why is this a good thing? Because it's telling a cool story. It's telling technically a story where you should be conflicted, because you're like, but I don't know if Yoshi is a good guy. We assume that he's a good guy, but will he give in to the obvious temptations that, yes, she's very attractive. Can he fight against that? And is his urges for her to have a better future stronger than his desires as a human being, and technically his own physical desires? And that's where it was interesting. I think my only troubles I really have, I think the supporting cast is fantastic. Don't get me wrong. I think Goto, the time that she had with Sayu to converse with her was fantastic. I think Mishima's conflicts in that she likes Yoshida and doesn't see her the same way. It's the unrequited love that Mishima has. I think it was well portrayed. I think it didn't go too far with it. I think it did just enough for her story. Asami was fantastic, the co-worker of Sayu. So it has a great supporting cast. But I think my only issue I have with the series is, looking back, I realized that most of the characters in their portrayal in the story was literally just to come in and say, hey, what you're doing is wrong. Oh, okay, so you're a good person, and then leave. So there is that conflict there. But I think they did enough. Because I think the idea of a lot of the supporting cast was really to point out the danger that they're facing. Now, you can make an argument that the story doesn't do enough to really have Yoshida realize how dangerous this is. And which you can make the argument that if he did, he'd just be in jail. I mean, because literally, if he runs to that point where, you know, you're going to get, you know, here is what you face, let's show it to you, he's in jail. And that would be a really quick story, unless it just, you know, season two, Yoshida's in jail. That's obviously the issue that they have there. But I think overall it looks great. It told some really fantastic storytelling. Like I said, I like the willingness to tell a taboo story. And I think that in the end, it was respectful of it. But yeah, that's my thoughts of Higahiro. I don't want to go any further. I keep wanting to go further, and then I stop myself. So check that out if that sounds interesting to you. But let's make a mug, too. This one is Yaku Nara Mug Cup Mo. This one streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. It was a 14-minute episode per episode series. Done by Studio Nippon Animation, the source is a manga, and the genres are slice of life. And this one opens up with a girl named Himeno, and her, along with her father, have moved from Tokyo to a small town. It's like, I think they said it's the town that's like 50% of all ceramics are made at. Something like that. It's like a big ceramic town. Like, that's what they're known for, apparently. But she's now at this home, because apparently her father was a salaryman and their company went under. So he decided to essentially invest into creating a cafe. And so he opens up a cafe in this small town. But Himeno ends up going to this new school. And at this school, which is apparently, this is the hometown also of her mother, who has passed away. And then when she gets to the school, she's invited to go. Well, she decides to introduce herself to her class as having all these mugs and that her father opened up a cafe and there's like 400 different types of mugs that you can choose from. Something like that, like an astronomical amount of mugs that you can choose from. And one girl like immediately jumps on it because she's a part of the ceramics club. And so she goes to this ceramics club and she gets to see how, you know, things are made with clay and they end up rediscovering that, you know, her mother was like this really famous person in that area for what she did with ceramics and stuff and clay. So that obviously gains her attention. And then she learns how to make mugs and hangs out with everybody and they all have fun. And then you like later on, you kind of get more and more into her mother and what all that stuff was. So your thoughts?
This one was probably, next to Super Cub, this was probably one of my surprises of the season. Going into this, you're expecting kind of a, you know, almost a sales of ceramics and please come and visit our town because it's pretty and there's lots of ceramics here. But what you end up getting out of this is actually some very solid character moments. I think out of all of the things that I came away from this this particular show with was some really honestly good drama beats that kind of actually are not well or are very well told, just not really expected. And that's the one thing that if I was to give this show anything, it would be that. Yeah, that it was kind of neat to get some how do you make a cup or how do you make a bowl or how do you make a wind thing in the middle of the forest? It's all here. So, but yeah, I did really come away from this very happy, very satisfied with what I got out of it because I was not expecting much of anything. I was just expecting, hey, this is how you make ceramics and this is how you paint it. And hey, pretty town. I got more.
Pretty town. There was a lot of pretty much ceramics 101. I mean, I specifically remember like the scene where it was like the second episode. They go into there and she's like, well, here's this thing. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's usually typically made here. And then she's like, oh, and this one's made from here. And then suddenly out of nowhere, super Genki girl Mika decides to draw an entire map of Japan. And then they start putting all these miniature mugs and everything.
Yeah.
And all these different locations to show where all these different types of styles of ceramics are made. And I'm like, TMI, I'm not going to remember any of this. I guess it kind of makes you a nice little. And no, they decided to make it
they
into a song.
They even told us where toilet bowls were made.
They decided to make it into a song that literally didn't rhyme whatsoever. So I'm not sure what that was about. I'm like, oh, cool. This could be like a catchy tune. No, this is not catchy. They're just talking over a beat. They're not really doing anything with that. But it was cute. So that was fine. But no, I agree. I think this is one of those cases of something that's more than what it really seemed like it was going to be early on. I think a lot of my enjoyment really came around Himeno, her mother's kind of walking in her mother's shoes to an extent.
Yeah.
Having like this moment where she's walking home and then realizes this kind of sense of the presence of her mom, like this is where she walked. And then kind of getting more of that, getting into, yeah, like the sculpture out in the forest, all that kind of stuff was really very emotional. I think a lot of my attachment, of course, is going to come in the idea of essentially the bonds that you gain with a member of your family when you lose another one. You almost have this sense of like there's a triangle, and the moment that you lose one of those corners, the two lines come closer together. And there it felt like that with her and her father, and I really did find a nice bond to that. I think that was really emotional. Even though at times it felt like he didn't realize what he was doing whenever he upset her.
She was trying so hard.
I don't remember where they really got into it, but it felt like they were trying to imply something with the ceramics making and his and her mother. Like, this is a dangerous thing. I don't remember really necessarily that they got into how the mother passed, unless I missed it. But that kind of bugged me at the very beginning, because it felt like, I'm not going to let her get sick too. And I'm like, wait, so the mother got sick doing clay or something? Is they have like a allergic reaction to clay, and it like never touches it ever again after that point? It almost felt like they were implying that she overworked herself, like, because of her craft. It was really cute, because they always play on the idea that the mother expressed herself through her ceramics. And so she would always create things that would be illogical, technically, and that's technically what Himeno did as well. Illogical things that would essentially express what they desired. And like I said, it never really got into the mother, and I'm guessing that maybe it's something later on in the manga, but I don't know. That was like the only thing that really kind of was left untold, but the rest of it really felt like a really nice little cute story of her getting introduced into ceramics, and not necessarily becoming a genius, because it plays heavy on the idea that she just keeps failing, even though she desires to be accepted and to see others like what she's doing, like almost that she's doing it just to please her father and stuff, but it always ends up blowing up in her face, which I think is nice. It's not that she's suddenly a genius and she's able to create, you know, works of art, but even though I would argue that what she made was pretty cool, it was interesting. But yeah, just some really cute little character moments. I think Mika was a little loud, I will admit. Naoko was a dork. I think at some point Himeno just turns into a straight man at some point. Just kind of, what are you doing? That's crazy. That's crazy. What are you doing? But yeah, it was cute. It had a fun style to it. I did learn a few things about making mugs and stuff, so that was pretty cool. It is always surprising when you technically have a common knowledge of something, but then you watch something like this where it seems like the creator is really passionate about a certain craft, and then you go, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know that. Yeah, I know that. Oh, that's interesting. and it was nice, because I think Toko was really cool in the idea that she felt like she was a very attentive teacher. Like, I loved that she was such a good teacher in that art. And I think that's something that helps her kind of progress with it. But yeah, Mika's just crazy. She's loud and she creates crazy things. But yeah, it was cute. I enjoyed it. It's not much of an investment. I mean, technically taking off the intro and outro, you're looking at probably 11 minutes per episode. So it's like not even a little bit over 2 hours worth of show. So it's not short levels where it's like you can watch the whole thing in literally 30 minutes, but it's pretty much a nice little easy to consume happy show. And I think it did a good job of kind of portraying that sense of adventure, exploring the idea of doing mugs and stuff, that it made it kind of cool. I would like to do that kind of thing, which is always nice with those. So if I have an argument with it, I would probably say, unlike with like how Super Cub does it, this is a little bit too on the nose with the whole prefecture advertisement stuff. I think it's a little bit heavy in certain regards.
Yeah, that's why I didn't even put this in the same level as Super Cub. Super Cub was fantastic. This, it was a nice surprise, but yeah, it wasn't as well directed as Super Cub was.
Yeah. Still better animated than Osamake. Let's make a mug coat. Yeah, let's make a mug too. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. Combatants will be dispatched, or Sentoin Hakanshimasu. This one is streaming on Funimation, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio JC staff. The source is a light novel, and the creator was Natsumi Akatsuki, of course, did Konosuba and Konomichi Rise Up. The director was Hiroaki Akagi, who did Hinaloji Look and Logic. Hinaloji Look and Logic? Was it Look and Logic? Yeah, Look and Logic. And TZ Master Takagi-san. Tongue twister. But yeah, this one basically follows a guy that's codenamed Number 6, and he is enlisted by the Kisaragi Corporation that he works for to basically spread their conquest to other worlds, because they've basically taken over the Earth. Even though it seems like there's some heroes that are still fighting back even to the end. They basically conquested Earth, and they're going to send him out to other worlds to take over other worlds. And they essentially send him along with Alice, who is an AI robot thing, through a teleportation to this other world, a teleportation that they haven't even tested, so they don't even know if it'll work. but he's ended up being transported to this other world, where he then has to essentially spy on the nations there and figure out how they can essentially take over those nations. And it seems like early on, instead of actually taking over the nation, he ends up just enjoying working for the kingdom because he gets paid better than what he does with Kisaragi Corporation. Yeah, it's just basically him infiltrating the nation and at the same time kind of doing work for them because they pay so well and keeping the Demon Lord's army at bay. And the other kind of goofy thing that they have with this is that essentially any of the evil deeds that somebody part of the Kisaragi Corporation does, they will gain points, and those points can then be spent to buy different items that they can buy. And the goofy thing with this is that obviously the evil deeds they do has to be like something that, you know, unwanted advancements or something like that with somebody. But the it ends up becoming like a really nice little joke and twist to the particular storytelling they do, because he's obviously doing evil deeds and suddenly you get the points and then he spends it to buy things, and it ends up turning into like a science versus magic element where there's it's a fantasy world, so there is magic, there is curses and stuff like that, but then he's here with a machine gun and he's shooting at stuff or something. So yep, that is Will Be Dispatched. Your thoughts?
This one is going to be really, really difficult for me to do because I am very mixed on it. In some respects, I found some episodes of this show absolutely hilarious. Other episodes, it just, okay, come on, let's move on. So I am very frustrated with it because I did really want to like this show. It does hit a lot of points that are kind of fun. Some of the ecchi humor is in here. They've got some weird goofy, like Andrew was mentioning, the weird system of evil points and how you gain evil points there, and some of that stuff was absolutely hilarious. And then there was their story, which would probably be my biggest, I not necessarily that I expected it to be much. I mean, it's literally them just giving the main character a reason to do what he's doing. But they don't really do much else. It's just they're out in the middle of the desert because, well, the princess told them to. Okay, so they're out there looking for water in a desert. And they bump into a big old mole thing.
Technically redesigned the cube that they used to summon resources.
Yeah, there was that. That was one of the funny parts.
So it requires somebody to say something very inappropriate or in front of a crowd in order to get it to work.
So, I mean, yeah, some of the goofy humor. But see, really what it comes down to is it's... I guess maybe I would have preferred ecchi humor, but this was more closer to probably potty humor. Either way, the humor didn't work for me. That's probably my biggest frustration is you go in expecting something hilarious, you don't really walk away with it, at least for me. But hey, it might work for a lot of people. Other than that, the characters were fun, generally. So it's a mixed bag. It really is.
I would definitely agree with you that this show has lulling points. I do like, kind of coming into the show, I think the thing that was so refreshing was that, I mean, after Kimono Michi Rise Up, that was kind of a disappointment for me personally. Getting into this one and really kind of having that same Konosuba feel was like, okay, it seems like this writer's kind of returning back to form. Like, this is what was successful. Obviously, Konosuba is a legend of comedy. And so you having that, okay, yeah, technically Snow is your Aqua character. Yeah, you can make an argument that Grimm is kind of like your Darkness character. Yeah, Rose pretty much is introduced with a explosion reference. So, and yeah, and number six is kind of an absolute zany goofball, like, I forget what his name is, the main character of Konosuba is. So it does have that kind of those trappings in there. But honestly, it doesn't, thankfully, it doesn't rely on them too heavy. I don't want Snow to be at Aqua. I don't want Grimm to turn into a darkness. I don't want Rose to be Megaman redesigned.
Right.
It's almost like it references and it has that feeling, but then, yeah, Rose isn't really a Chunin. It just references it because she says that her creator said to act like this, and she never really does it again. She just turns into a goofball that wants to bite things so that she can gain powers, which is, you know, funny in its own right. Snow being really kind of heavily in debt and constantly trying to keep her status so that she can make money to pay off her debt because she keeps buying swords and they keep breaking and it costs her a fortune. Grimm just turning into she uses curses on people, and if she fails, it goes upon herself. Why is she in a wheelchair? Because she's cursed to never wear shoes. It's kind of funny. So, and just kind of she's very misfortunate. She's a very misfortunate character. She's not, I want to be hurt, like Darkness is. So it's not the same thing, technically.
Poor Grimm. Grimm was absolutely hilarious the first time that they kind of got into her. And every time they use her, it's literally her joke is she's asleep during the most important part.
Yeah, she's fantastic when she's actually awake. Her entire episode was great. And basically, Alice questioning her abilities being fake was a hilarious episode, too. But no, I think each individual points are really hilarious. I do like the characters a lot. Number six is really a goofball. It's almost like he knows that he isn't an overpowered character, but every now and then he thinks that he is. It's like it's science versus fantasy. So a lot of it's really strategy versus, you know, the common denominator. And so a lot of the cases when there is an issue, you know, the army's like, let's go fight on the field with them, with honor. And he's like, no, let's just go over here and cut off their supplies. And like, well, that's dirty, but we'll win if we do that.
Yeah.
Let's just starve them to death. I mean, it's all we have to do. And then when it comes to like the demon lords invading, what does number six say? He looks to Alice and they both look at each other and they go, let's get out of here. They're like, literally, let's get out of here. Like, we're not heroes. We're not here to save you guys.
Yep.
It's the self-interest thing, which technically makes it a lot of the fun with this series. So like I said, it does have a lot of really great moments. The comedy is really there. It is it's return to form like Konosuba. But again, you have Michi's Rise Ups over here. You have Konosuba's over here on this side. This is kind of in the middle. Like, yeah. It's not the relentless hilarity that Konosuba is. It has so many lulling points. I would argue it has equal lulling points to funny points, which is technically not a good thing because that's half your screen time. So it has a lot of clever aspects there. I think the only thing that I'm really disappointed with the series, honestly, is what's its gimmick? Like, what is the thing that makes this so unique? It's the evil point system.
Yeah.
And it, especially like in the middle segment, doesn't really use it. Like, this is your, like suddenly out of nowhere when he has this point where he's trying to gain points and he's literally running around the street, unzipping himself in front of people. And then he ends up running into some lady that wants it. He's not getting any points because you want this.
Well, they even did that with Snow at some point.
Yeah. Like, you actually want this, don't you? Whenever it does it, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. This has this element in the show. Like, it surprises me because I forget that this is a thing in the show. And every time it does it, it's hilarious. The, you know, putting the demon lady up on a rock and, you know, and humiliating her just to get a bunch of points was crazy. So it has its tie. It has its chemistry. It has the characters. That's the thing. It's like, it has fantastic characters.
Yeah.
It just doesn't do enough really fun things with them to keep that momentum of comedy going. It has too many lulling points. So that's really where I struggle with it. It's kind of a half and half mixed bag. But it has great characters. It has great chemistry. Some really great funny moments. I kind of agree. Having this kind of overlaying storyline itself kind of feels like there's no point to, like, every now and then whenever they go to talk to the heads of the Kitsuragi Corporation, it's like, why are they even there? It's like, what is even the point of them? Like, okay, they're fighting heroes. What are you even here for? Does definitely make you question, but it has potential there. It's just, I just wish it kind of played off it more, but it was still an entertaining series. Gets pretty questionable with the tiger guy. That one got pretty heavy with the lolicon thing. But yeah, that's Combatants Slowly Dispatched. Like I said, I kind of miss the characters because I enjoy them so much. I've been killing slimes for 300 years and maxed out my level, or slime Tao Shite 300 Nen Shira Nai Uchi Ni Level Max Ni Nate Mashita. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Reveroot. The source is a light novel, and this one follows Aizawa, in her previous life, she was an office worker, ends up unfortunately passing away. And the goddess, upon meeting her, kind of goes, you know, I kind of favor girls. I kind of want to give you a better life. So she's going to reincarnate her into another world. And she lets her kind of decide what she wants. Like, you know, is there anything special you want? And she decides that she wants to be 17 and basically live forever, like eternal youth, you know, immortal kind of thing. And so she agrees to it, sends her to this fantasy world setting world. And she is now a witch there and never ages. And what it turns into is she ends up finding a little house there, and she realizes the goddess put the house there for her for to live in. And she decides to start her now relaxed life. She was living a, you know, salary person, getting, you know, overworked. Now she just wants to relax and just take it easy. So thus begins this kind of really quick run through of 300 years, where every day she has a cycle where she would go out to the town, and on her way, she would kill slimes on the way, collect these little gems they drop, then take them to the Adventure Guild, where they will essentially give her money for those, and then she will, you know, hit up the market and then go back home. And that's for 300 years of doing this. And at some point, like, you know, 300 years later, when there's this, you know, obviously a new person working at the Adventure Guild, and she's like, can I see your stats? You know, you've been here for a long time. Let me see your stats. And she's like, yeah, well, it's not going to be much. I just killed, like, a couple slimes every day. And then she ends up finding out that she ends up having, like, a skill that multiplies the experience she gains. But then again, having killed so many slimes every single day for 300 years, she maxed out her level. And so, obviously, this kind of catches the interest of her. But she's like, no, keep it a secret. I don't want attention. I want to live in a normal life. But somebody else overhears it. So, you know, the cat comes out of the bag. Everybody finds out there's this witch that lives over in this location. And she's level 99. She's maxed out. And she starts getting attention house that she calls. Doesn't want. Yeah, knocks on the door every single day. So yeah, different people keep showing up. The first one being this dragon that just wants to test out, you know, the strongest person out there. And then eventually some slime spirits and an elf girl that has a super energy drink kind of pattern, and this demon lord that is seeking the elf, and the blue dragons, the dead person, demon lord, all that kind of stuff. So your thoughts?
I really did love the show. Just too much fun between the main character and building bonds and with a lot of these other characters. The silly hijinks that they ensue in each one of these characters. Of course, the slime girls, always going to have a soft spot in my heart for them. But I did really like the two dragon characters. Just truth be told, I think the only one that I didn't much care for was probably the elf.
She was really annoying at first, but
she was sweet, but she was just kind of a little bit obnoxiously annoying with her goofy, I have to solve every problem, but my solving the problem is the worst solution when it comes down to it. I really did love a lot of this show. Each one of the characters had their own charm in their own way. I loved it.
No mention of Pecora. Pecora was a nut.
Yeah, she was. I out of the two dragons, I liked her a lot. I really did.
Demon Lord. Pecora's the demon lord.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Flatori was a goof as well. The submission thing, horn thing. No, I kind of in the same boat. I didn't. This is one of those shows where I watched the first few episodes for our first impressions, and I kind of just didn't get back to it. And it wasn't really a thing that I didn't like it. I just know that it wasn't going to do anything like standout-ish. Now, granted, a lot of the draw to go back to it is that Aoyuki plays the main character, and Aoyuki is fantastic. And it was interesting to get like a take of Aoyuki where she's not screaming and you know, overly gruffy with her voice, just kind of a normal take with Aoyuki's voice, which is kind of refreshing. You usually get like Cruel Tempest where she's more, you know, draw to her voice, and it's more sinister. And then you have, you know, in Clementine as well with Overlord, and then, you know, and technically, you know, just thinking like that crazy version of Aoyuki, or the bombastic over the top one with Spider So What. And this was like more of a natural Aoyuki, which I, being a huge fan of Aoyuki, I really did want to experience. But it was kind of one of those things where it's like, it's just a fun show. It's a fun, relaxing show. It's cute. It's fun. You're almost experiencing the same thing she is, just trying to have a relaxed, enjoyable life. It's definitely the, of any of the isekai, the question always comes up, which isekai would you want to be in? And it's always like, yeah, but almost every single isekai is like, you're going to go there and you're probably going to die.
Yep.
None of it sounds fun. It seems fun because we see the harem, we see the character go overcome things, but I don't want to die a million times like ReZero. It's very rare where you have an isekai where it's like, yeah, that would be a fun experience. This is one of them. It's like, this would be fun. It's just chill, spend time with a bunch of cute girls. And it was so funny because the repeating punchline is obvious that she wanted to be alone, but then every 2 seconds, a knock on the door. And it even jokes about the fact of, you know, all we really need now is an elf, and then suddenly knock on the door and it's an elf behind the door. It's like, it literally jokes about the fact that it's literally just collecting a harem of girls to hang out with her. Now, granted, you can argue that it's not really necessarily harem because she's more of a mother figure to the slime. She's more of a, you know, a sister to this character and all that kind of stuff. But it's really cute in that regard because it's not trying to dance around the idea that, you know, it's just her having fun, creating a family, basically, and then eventually getting to that point where she no longer sees it as a bother, but as a family that she wants to protect and be with. And that was really cute because it obviously implies that in her previous life, she was just working all the time. She didn't really have anything, and she just dies. And now she gets to have, you know, a family that she can be with. Now she has people that she wants to be with. And there's not that idea of being under a work environment. It is really cute because they play on the idea of overworking as well with Laika, and how Laika wants to work herself to death. And she's like, no, don't do that. Never do that. Because she obviously remembers what she's been through.
Yeah, she even flat out said, if you want to work for me, you are not going to work all the time.
Yeah. It is really cute. It's a very cute show. A lot of fun. Very laid back. Has a few really funny comedy moments. It's not the most, you know, over-the-top impressive visuals, but it was funny the other day. I was almost tempted to drag Chris in here as I was watching it. Obviously, he had already finished it, but I'm like, I'm getting caught up on it. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, reacquaint him because I wasn't sure if he's going to remember when we did the review. It's like, every now and then, the show has some really incredible animation pieces. Like, there is actual, you know, Sakuga in here. Like, there is moments where I'm like, well, that's really impressive. Like, one off the top of my head was when Rosalie and they were on the Leviathan, and Rosalie was on this balcony, and I think, the elf girl comes out to talk to her, and it's just like this beautiful skyscrape and the visual effects of, like, the animation and the hair and everything. I was like, this looks really good. And of course, you had moments like when she first fights Laika, they obviously have a really bombastic fight. But I expect that with the first episode. Like, the first episode, you have to have those crazy animation points. But this show had a lot of really, really beautiful moments that really did surprise me that I wasn't really expecting from just a random comedy set guy that doesn't really need to be overly animated. And it's not that it's like, you know, crazy. I mean, obviously, when the blue dragons and the red dragons fought, they did some crazy animation there as well. It's not like action, always action oriented. It's just the subtle animations that make something, like we mentioned with Super Cub, just her doing her morning routine of, you know, filling with her cup, her bento box with her rice and pouring the drink and everything. Those overly detailed animation points that they didn't really have to do. But they do it. So it has some impressive animation points. Really great characters. I loved all the characters. I don't think there was a single character I didn't like. Like I said, I had my issues with the elf girl at first, but she kind of grew on me over time. They were just all fantastic. I think the whole sequence with Picora, the demon lord, was hilarious. A lot of fun there. Rosalie was pretty heartbreaking at first, and they kind of pulled her into the mix. Was really cute. I always love whenever they pull Beelzebub into situations. They always, of course, have to summon her and dump her in water.
Dump her in the water.
But it's always like this thing of like Beelzebub, you'd think of this like fearful character, but she just somehow breaks her every single time, pulls her into the mix. The slime girls, you know, get her Doki Dokis going and look kawaii in front of them. Just a really great cast, really great moments, really laid back, a lot of fun, really did enjoy my time on it. I wasn't really expecting, like I said, I didn't have any problems with it coming into it because of the first impressions, but I really did enjoy it in the end. So I'm glad I got caught up on it. But yeah, that's, I've been killing slimes for 300 years and maxed out my level. Check that out if you will. Koi Kimo is our next one, or Koi to Yobu ni wa Kimochi Warui. This one streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. Done by Studio Nomad, the source is a web manga, and the genres are comedy and romance. And the series composition by Yuko Kakihara, who did Asabase, Chiai Hafuru, and As the Moon So Beautiful. And this one follows essentially two main characters, one being Ryo, who is a 27-year-old, and a high schooler, who is 17-year-old. And at some point, while Ryo, who is this 27-year-old, is going to walk down some stairs, he ends up losing his step because he's kind of overworked and tired. He nearly falls down these stairs, but this girl, this 17-year-old, ends up seeing him, hooking him with her umbrella hook, and saving him from falling down the stairs. And she, like, gives him her bento or her lunch because she sees that he's, like, overworked and tired, and then runs off. And he kind of thinks about this whole thing, ends up eating the food. And then later on, as he's visiting his home, because he actually lives in an apartment, but every now and then he visits his parents' home where his sister lives. And when he's there, he ends up running into this girl again because this girl is actually the friend of his little sister. And we found out during this time, as time progressed, that Ryo is kind of a, you know, just likes to sleep with a lot of women. He's very much a ladies man kind of thing. And so he kind of tries to use his little charms on this girl, this 17-year-old, to kind of win her over because he's charmed by her. But then she really quickly turns and says, "You're creepy." And this kind of hits him like, wow, this girl just shot right through me. And he immediately falls in love with her. Like, this is this girl that, like, usually the women just fawn for me. I can get any woman kind of thing. And here's this girl that just seen right through me, called me a creep. He kind of likes it. So this kind of begins this whole thing where he keeps kind of trying to pursue her, keeps telling her that he loves her, wants to go out with her, buys her things. Like, literally, he buys her a present every single day and sends it to her. And she obviously sees him as creepy because he's a 27-year-old and doesn't really have any affection towards him. And then it kind of creates this whole thing of, over time, you kind of learn more about Ryo, that he really had some troubling past. His father really didn't like him. Him and Ryo, who is his little sister, kind of had a falling out because of the whole situation. Or not a falling out, but a separation because of the whole situation with the father. And now he's kind of conversing with his sister again because he just obviously wants more information about this high schooler that he likes. And on the other side, this high schooler, Ichika, is just kind of trying to dodge his advances and just, you know, finding him creepy and just getting annoyed by him calling all the time and just trying to live her life normal. That's kind of the thought process. Eventually, over some time, you'll find that there's another lover interest of Ichika that is her age. And then you have, you know, obviously love interests on Ryo's side that are his age. And, of course, the whole age gap conundrum that obviously is going to create a lot of raised eyebrow like Hikihiro did. First of all, this show is okay visually. I'm not bothered too much by it. It's very simple rom-com visuals. Audio-wise, terrible. Like, this show never gets good either. It's like, early on, my frustration was that, like, everybody sounded very off and they're very muffled. And at some point, some of the characters start getting better. It was almost like suddenly out of nowhere they start going in the studio or something like that and actually doing proper recording. But Ryo, a lot of the male characters seem like they never really fixed. Like, especially Ryo, just always sounded like he's talking into... Like, you remember back in the day, we used to get cans, and we used to poke a hole in the bottom and stick a string, and we'd talk to each other through it? Sounds like that. It's like he's talking into a vegetable can all the time. And that was like really annoying. But early on I actually enjoyed it because it was a cute show. Like, he wasn't really trying too hard. It was just kind of cute. He is kind of trying to charm this girl and her constantly saying, "You're a creep, go away." But it wasn't, again, similar to Higihiro, you obviously have the issue of an older man and a younger girl. This being literally 10-year gap, her technically still being a high schooler, again, hitting on the idea that this is technically not allowed, very much a taboo subject. But it wasn't as if he was ever touching her. And that was kind of what it made it a little bit okay to stomach, is the idea that he's not necessarily, you know, trying to throw her into the bed or anything like that. And she's not, you know, obviously undressing herself in front of him or anything. It's just him constantly calling her on a daily basis, sending her presents and trying to charm her. Whereas technically before, he was a womanizer. He was constantly taking women to bed and ditching them in the morning and didn't really have any feelings for any of these women that are all fawning over him. He just kind of just went about his, you know, his routine. So it was cute in that regard, even though I was kind of stomaching the really crappy audio. And it did get a little bit more, it got a little bit more frustrating, the idea when they did introduce people, they had to introduce characters within their age group that were pursuing them, and you knew that wasn't going to work out because literally the title is "This Love is Disgusting." These are the two main characters. They obviously have to have feelings for each other. Anything else is not going to work out. The moment that these other characters show up, I'm like, it's not going to work out for you. Don't even bother. These writers, as much as I love Japanese writing, when they get a romance set up, it's that's what's going to be. That's the character on the front cover in volume one. It's going to be the pick in the end. And I would make more of an argument against this one than Higihiro and the idea that it's not respectful of that concept of age gap. So I will keep that in mind. Like, I don't know how Ryo didn't get arrested in the end. That's all I'll say. Like, he should have been arrested in that last, in those final scenes. But at the same time, it technically does play off the idea of they are willing to skirt around the obvious difficulties that faces in society. Like, there is a option that we can get around this and we can do that. It's just they kind of mess it up by having Ryu do something that he probably shouldn't have in the end, which technically makes it difficult to suggest in the end. But yeah, it's a struggle for me, because I think the series as a whole, ignoring the fact that there is a huge age difference here, it is cute. It has charm to it. I do like Ryo as a character, and I do like Ichika and her very standoffish to him. What I'm saying. Her rejection of him constantly was fun. I did find a lot of that stuff humorous. It's just unfortunate that, I don't know, it just didn't have enough really in it that really set itself out from a lot of other shows, especially romance-wise. It doesn't really have much there. It's just really him constantly hitting on her until she obviously starts having feelings for him or thinks that she does. He does some really cute things for her, like when she's sick, he made a whole study guide for her to help her out to get kind of caught up. So there's some sides of him that are definitely endearing and enjoyable. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
With the audio issues, okay, and everything, it's a struggle.
I've got to ask, is she giving off vibes of being into him or what? I mean, he flat out sounds like, yeah, a full-on stalker.
He is full-on stalker. I mean, it's one of those struggling things where technically he's just not getting a hint. It's not that she is. It's one of those things where you keep pulling the reel, but every now and then it gives slack. So you think you can pull it again. It's kind of that concept. She's not necessarily ignoring his phone calls, and she answers the phone calls. So it's like you're technically allowing him to kind of keep progressing, keep pushing forward. So it is one of those struggling things where it's like, yeah, she's technically allowing it. She's not fully walking away. She's not fully ignoring him. So she's technically allowing it to happen, and that's enough for him to get in there. So Yep, that's
she's not a brix, is she?
That's Koikimo. No, she was a cute okay. character. She's normal. She's a very normal character. So, Shadow House. So I'm streamed on Funimation, ran for 13 episodes, done by Studio CloverWorks. The source is a manga. The genres are slice of life, supernatural, and seinen. And this one takes place in the Shadow House, which kind of opens up showing that these, essentially, this person, main focus early on this series, I don't even know how to explain the show, main focus on the show in the early segments is that you have this Shadow House, which has all the Shadow House family members. All these Shadow House family members look like just kind of people with no complexion. They're just, their entire body is a shadow. And each one of these Shadow family members seem to have a living doll that kind of works as like a maid to them. But over time, you'll kind of learn that it seems like the living dolls that work for these different individual Shadow House members is supposed to become like the expression of the Shadow House family member. So essentially, if they were to go out to meet somebody, they wouldn't see their face because they're full shadow. So the living doll would be at their side always to give their expression. So if they're laughing, the living doll would have to have an expression of laughing. And as it kind of goes along, you mainly focus on following Emilico, who is one of these living dolls for this girl named Kate. And through Emilico's awakening in this particular Shadow House, she is obviously exploring what she is supposed to do, what her role is to clean up the soot that that Kate herself emits, because each one of these shadow members apparently emits soot from them, especially when, specifically with Kate, whenever she's in distress, she'll kind of have this little trailing come up. It fills up the room. So the living doll has to clean the room on a daily basis. If they don't clean the soot, it will eventually turn into a shadow creature that will cause damage. So they have to make sure it's cleaned up. Eventually, she's able to leave the room, and she's able to join the other living dolls as they clean up the rest of the mansion. And then eventually leading to Kate, along with many other Shadow House family members, along with their living dolls, having to go to this whole process they call the debut, where essentially the Shadow House member, when they get to a certain age, they're able to do a debut, which they go there with their living doll and essentially prove that they have what it takes to become an actual Shadow House family member. So that's about as far as I'll go into it. But yeah, your thoughts on Shadow House.
Out of curiosity, if just to throw it out there, if I had went ahead and skipped this show, would you have dragged me into it?
Yeah.
This show,
there was only like one part in it that I was like, oh, that's gonna be rough for Chris to watch.
Yeah, there was I am so glad that I went ahead and went with my against my first instincts, because my first instincts on this show was this is a dark show. I mean, it comes across as a dark show, and it technically is. It does have a dark feel to it, but it never actually gets dark per se. It's just a feeling of being dark. The storyline,
it's a dark theme.
Yeah,
gothic dark.
I came into this mostly because I seen Frills, and I can't ignore Frills when it comes to character artwork. And this
but
is
you ignore Wonder Egg Priory that literally has a character named Frill.
When I went into this show, it was literally for the Victorian style that these characters come off with, and I was so pleasantly happy. This is a really neat little mystery story. What's under each. Rock as you go through the story. I love the characters. The characters were fantastic. The storyline itself is really well done. There's a bigger storyline that we hope to get into. Was this an original or no? It's a manga. That eventually we'll get to. So it's a lot of fun. I can't wait. I hope they do another season of this. I really, really liked it.
Yeah, that was one of the troubling things. I literally thought you were going to ask me what my thoughts on the idea of it being complete story or it being a chapter close. And honestly, I wasn't really sure how they were going to conclude that 13th episode. I honestly was feeling like, oh, crap, they're just like running down this rabbit hole. And I don't know how they're going to get out of this and conclude it in a spot that I like it. But it actually pulled it off. It somehow managed to make that last episode just build up a huge, like troubling situation, and then just give it a nice little kind of end cap to it and a nice chapter close. But yeah, this show is, it's kind of like this constant like peeling of an onion, not the tearing thing, just like the layers that it's constantly kind of unraveling as it's kind of exploring, okay, what does the living doll do? What is the purpose of the living doll? What are the Shadow House family members? Why do they emit soot? Why are they nothing but a silhouette, basically? How do they express themselves? Do the living dolls have to essentially mimic the Shadow House family member? It doesn't necessarily imply... It almost has like this sense of obscurity in what they're actually supposed to do. Is Emilico supposed to just become a mimic of Kate? Kate obviously wants her to be her own self. It's just all these little interesting things that it kind of slowly unravels. This almost like the mechanisms and the intricacies of the mansion itself. Like, how does it work? How do the people move around? What are they supposed to do? The shadows, the soot, the soot's creating these little phantom things. The soot sickness. The debut. What's the debut for? Who's the other Shadow House family members? Why are they kind of on looking with all the situations? The Starbearer, like all these cool little intricate things about this, just this little mansion these people are in, was totally fascinating to me. And I was loving every little bit that was unraveling as it went along. And I was really surprised because, and this is, I guess, again, one of those little kind of telling things about us dealing with anime and how it seems like they're all just advertisements for their source material. As I totally wasn't expecting them to reveal as much as they did. Like, I don't want to sound like it's a complaint. It's like, wow, they actually revealed way more than I thought they would. Like, I didn't think we were going to get into all this stuff in this adaptation. I literally thought so much of this, what was revealed in this anime, would have been something they would keep way later in the manga that we'd have to eventually, you know, go read, because obviously, unfortunately, they don't really adapt too much of source materials anymore. But it was cool. I love that they did that. I love that I got to see really so much of this. There's only really two major factors of the overall story that is still left, obviously, to be told in the source material or hopefully another season. And that's really kind of more focused around, I don't want to mention that one, but, you know, what's the grandfather doing? Like, what is the grandfather's goal, essentially? Because there is obviously this great father that is above everybody, and it seems like he's, you know, obviously being the head of the household, he is the puppet master of everything, and trying to figure out what he wants is really a major focus that they'd obviously get into later. But yeah, I loved all that they got into. I loved all the mystery of this series. I just ate it all up. I cannot express enough how much I enjoyed just unraveling this piece by piece. Yeah, the aesthetic is way appealing. I love the style of it. I love the gothic feel of it. I can probably argue it's a little bit too dark. Sometimes you can't even tell what's going on, but it has a visual style to it that I absolutely love. I couldn't get enough of it. I kind of miss it because I love speculating on stuff. Thankfully, this is one of the few ones where I actually called quite a bit of it, and in a season where I kept speculating on a lot of shows and my impressions and failed miserably, this is one of the few ones that I actually did pretty good with. So maybe it was just too obvious. I don't know. But and it has some really tragic moments. Like I was mentioning, I had one particular point in this series that something happened and I was like, oh crap. Chris is not going to like this, but at the same time, he's too invested at this point.
I loved that call out on the video. You're too far in it, Chris. Yeah, just keep on going.
You're stuck. It's too bad. Really good, though. I'm going to miss it. I love it so much. I cannot express enough. This is a fantastic series. Definitely up there as a anime of the year contender for me. Emilico is just so... I loved Emilico as a character. She's not too ganky. She's ganky in spirit, but not in loudness, I guess is what I would put it. Yeah. Like, she is a ray of sunshine. I love that one of the characters actually literally calls her, like, sunshine or something like that. Because it's, like I said, it's a very kind of dark gothic feel to the entire show and setting and theme. But she's always, like, that thing that seems to pull people forward. Like, yeah. There's this whole gloomy point in which they're kind of stuck in a situation where they're being blamed for something. And she's constantly just pushing them forward in that kind of positive nature. It's really the positivity that she has. And yeah, and how that technically puts Kate in a very difficult situation later. I loved all that stuff. So definitely highly suggest it. Like I said, a really solid chapter close for it too. Even though I do want more, they did do a good job of kind of giving a nice little, conclusion for now. So Shadow House, highly recommend it. Fantastic. 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 So My Spider, So What? Or Kumo Desuka Nanika. This one's streamed on Crunchyroll for 24 episodes. Done by Studio Milipinzi. I hate that studio. Source is a light novel. Genres are adventure, comedy, and fantasy. Yeah, so this one pretty much opens up a bunch of high schoolers in a, you know, obviously pretty modern, typical setting of Japan. Suddenly find a big bright light appearing in the classroom, and then they are all essentially reincarnated into another world, a fantasy world. Whereas a lot of them seem to have been reincarnated into, you know, different families, one being like Shun, who's a part of this family, who's actually the younger brother of the hero of this world. Some are in nobility, some are in royalty, some are orphaned and end up at churches. Some are elves. There are some that are actually reincarnated as monsters, including Kumiko, who in the previous life was kind of the outcast girl. She didn't really speak much. She kind of kept to herself, was bullied every now and then. She is now a spider, as the title would lead you to believe. And she hatches from an egg, and she's quickly kind of fighting to survive. It's not really, she's in like the depth, the deepest depths of this labyrinth. And she's kind of trying to fight to get to the surface, to get to, you know, safety, while at the same time being attacked by different monsters and having to struggle to survive. And like I said, on the other side of the whole story, you have a lot of focus on Shun, who again is the younger brother of this hero, and all of them kind of joining an academy together and learning to get a little bit more combat skills and all the stuff that are kind of surrounding that. Eventually, they get confronted by their teacher, who ends up being an elf. And she's kind of trying to gather all the reincarnates in this world, trying to keep them safe, get them gathered up, and all that kind of entails with that. So, yeah. Your thoughts?
Okay.
I'm really interested in Chris's thoughts. This is kind of a nice thing of me doing the intros and stuff, is that I can allow him to jump out there in the fire first.
Beefs aside,
cheater.
I know where you're gonna go, and I can't argue with it. I really can't. It didn't detract from it enough for me. Visual wise it didn't detract from it enough for me.
Anyways, go ahead.
The only thing I would probably beef at would probably be the 3D crap. I didn't, or the CG crap. I didn't much care for that, but other than that, I thought overall, it was aesthetically fine. I liked the characters. I liked the storyline. I loved the way that it interwove between the two and kept me guessing as to different things throughout the entire show. As far as the storyline, the only thing that I would really beef with would probably be the amount of time it took to get to certain points. I'm not going to say it just felt like it was working on getting out of the mud puddle, but it never quite got out of the mud puddle. It wasn't like it was spinning wheels. It felt like it was constantly progressing. It just was very, it had a very meandery pace to get to that point. But I do feel like it was necessary, because it was almost like each one of these skills were building on each other. And so it was kind of necessary. I think that it probably would have done a little bit better. I honestly, truth be told, I wouldn't want to read this book. I really, really wouldn't. But I can see how it would translate better in the book than it did on the screen. So six in one hand, half dozen in the other. Do I think it was handled well? Yes and no. I think it was necessary, but at the same time, it was still really, really hard to get through a lot of this stuff, because it just took so long to get through the building upon the building upon the building until we got to a point where we could actually start seeing payoff, which was literally three quarters of the way through the first core, or whatever you want to call it. And then for the last three quarters of the show, I had a lot of fun. I think that a lot of the stuff was really neat. The ideas were really cool. And like we said before, this writer has a very good, very adept at misdirection, making you wonder, is it this direction or is it this direction what we're going? When all was said and done, we had pretty much guessed what we were guessing, and it did fine at that. So I had fun. Yes, I really did like the show. All said and done, I think it's a well done show. I'm not going to say phenomenal. I almost did, but I think it was a well done show. I really do.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to feel like the bad guy now. You did a good job of hiding all your frustrations. No, I don't. I honestly don't understand how you could have liked the or been okay with the visuals. It's funny because early on, a lot of my issues was around the fact that, because essentially, for those that have not watched the series, there's two sides to this. There's essentially for pretty much the entirety of the 24 episodes, you have this kind of story over here of Kumiko, and then you have the story over here, which is, as I joke about it, adolescence Game of Thrones, which is all the other students essentially, one, training, and then two, eventually getting to this whole kind of stupid clash that I could give two rips about. So on this side with Kumiko, it's all CGI, and on this side, it's kind of trying to keep to 2D animation, if you want to call it animation. And I was fine how Kumiko looked. I thought she was cute. It was a lot of fun watching her throughout the beginning segments because it's her basically panicking and freaking out about everything. And then you had like all these really terrible looking CGI monsters that she would run into that literally don't match her style. Like, they put all this effort into making her very unique, look really cool, but it almost looked like they just take these generic monster models and just threw them into here from some other assets, from some other thing. And they don't fit because they're either too detailed or they have too much shine to them, where she's more like a very matte look to her visual and textures on her character. So they don't match. Like, they clash. They're too, these monsters don't look like they fit in the same world visually as her. And that was a lot of my annoyance. It's like, over here I'm dealing with, you know, the models being different. And then over here on the Adolescence Game of Thrones side, I'm seeing a lack of animation, but not just that, but a lack of, I guess, what was the best way to put it? The area awareness, I guess. Like, I can't tell who's in the room sometimes because of how it's putting characters smashed up against the camera with another character sliding behind him and talking behind his face. Like, I can't get a feel of how close characters are from each other. I can't get a feel of who's in a room, so I don't know what's happening. I don't know the significance of what this character is doing because I don't know how close he is and how intimidating he is to this other character. That's the best way I can put it, is I don't have an idea of what's going on to know who's attacking who or what's happening to who or who's confronting who. It just looks like you're just shoving faces in front of the camera too close to each other, and it doesn't make any sense. Like, there's a later battle way later on where this character's way over here, something happens to the character way over here, and then it cuts to them looking like they're right next to each other, but they're not. They're not near each other, but yet their faces are, like, crammed next to each other in the camera. And it's that aspect that I honestly think it goes from just bad animation, which I can deal with. I've dealt with bad animation in shows. We watched Quality Code because I love the story. But at least I knew what was happening. I knew what was happening in the room. Whereas this one, it affects the storytelling because I don't know what's happening and I don't know who's confronting who or where they're at in the room. And that's the problem that I see in that lack of animation that they're basically doing with this. So that's my big, huge rant about the visuals. I think it looked terrible. And I think it's an unfortunate for this series because I think it's a stain on the storytelling. And I know I'm not alone in that because I can't tell you how many people I've seen countlessly commented on our videos of seeing the same problem. This looks terrible. This is a terribly animated show. So that aside, we've gotten that out of the way. Audio-wise, I think it was fine. I didn't really have too many problems with it audio-wise. There's nothing in there music-wise or anything that stood out whatsoever. It's just it was fine. It worked. The story itself. So my thoughts on the first core, which I think a majority of the first core was really kind of introduction to everybody on the human side of things and really a focus on Kumiko leveling up and trying to get out of the labyrinth. And I struggled with this section because I love it because a lot of my enjoyment was around Aoyuki as Kumiko and her over-the-top acting. Like, literally, Aoyuki carried this show. Like, if I would make the argument that if you put anyone else in place of Aoyuki as Kumiko, this show would have probably lost my interest a long time ago. And I think for a lot of people, she made that character. She's kind of like Kinjo Suda makes House Husband. Aoyuki makes Kumiko. Her voice, her acting, her over-the-top bombastic reaction to things sold me on Kumiko as a character. I loved her so much because of that. But I will admit that as it went along and they kept with this idea of her trying to get out of the labyrinth and her leveling up and her getting skills and her killing monsters and her leveling up and her getting skills, I got sick of it really quickly. And I struggled through a lot of that whole segment. Is just, are we still doing this? Can we move on already? Like, I love the fact that Slime, when Reincarnated as a Slime did it, it was literally within the first episode he was out there. And I'm like, great. And I feared it. I'm like, oh, here we go. He's gaining his skills. Got another skill. Okay, we're out of this. Okay, cool. We're already moving on. Great, cool. Let's do that. This one's like, nah, let's just stay in here for a while. Let's stay in here for a long time. And I got tired of it. I honestly did. I have to admit that. There's going to be a lot of people that disagree with me. And I think a lot of people were more acceptant of what she was going through just because they didn't want to see the other side of the story, which was Shun and all them. And it was funny because I thought about it. I wonder if a lot of that draw wasn't the idea that Kumiko was going through so much crap. Like, she was literally struggling to survive. She's literally at the brink of death so many times. And then it would cut over to this other side where all these stupid kids are standing around in school and nobility and safety, and they're complaining about stuff. And so it kind of creates that contrast of, like, did we hate these kids so much because of what we were seeing Kumiko go through? Or did we literally just see it like I did, where I don't care, Hugo, shut up. Going beyond that, as the story progresses and it kind of starts getting more into the idea of essentially trying to create a connection between these two stories. Like I said, it's the Shun side and the Kumiko side. And eventually you start seeing the threads created between the two of them. And it started creating this really cool concept, this really cool idea that I actually really enjoy, and I think a lot of other people enjoyed, of all this speculation that you can start to create of, oh, is this a reference to this? Is basically, what are those ties between the two sides, and can they eventually cross that bridge and we can finally have these two sides meet each other? I don't know why, but it's kind of similar to Afureta, where it's like, why do I desire so much for this character to finally meet these? Of course, with Afureta, a lot of it's to do with, you want to kind of see him confront the guys that kicked him off the bridge. You want to see him come up and say, now I'm awesome and now I'm super overpowered. What now? You want to see that the confronting of these people that wronged him because he was so weak before. And you kind of want to see that with this. You want to see this girl who was, you know, the outcast of the class walk up as this overpowered spider and, you know, rub it in their face or something. So seeing those connections and trying to draw those connections and trying to speculate on these different things was a lot of the enjoyment. And it's funny because we were talking about the idea of misdirection. It's like, yeah, there's technically a lot of misdirection, but it's unfortunately, I will have to say some of that misdirection is just something that we technically were fabricating because we wanted to speculate on stuff so much that when it came time to really kind of start revealing things and bring the two lines together, kind of disappointing. it was disappointing for me, but I struggle. I think it's visually garbage. I really think the studio, don't get me wrong, visuals strictly this studio. It's nothing to do with the story. I I did enjoy my time watching this series and speculating on things. I just think so much of it was ruined by the studio. I think the studio did the story wrong. And I wonder how much of my disappointments in this, any elements of the story, was mainly due to the studio. Did they just do a terrible job adapting it? And I've heard way too many stories about things that I would struggle with. Like, there was this one aspect of the characters being mad at the teacher. And I'm like, I don't understand this. These characters technically should be more mature than this.
Because I agree with that.
Obviously, they're teenagers. In the modern times, they grew up to be teenagers. You know, let's shoot 14. Let's just shoot 14. And then they were transported to this other world, reborn, and grew up another, say, 14 years. They should be adults now, in mind. And plus, they're in this other world where things are a lot rougher. I mean, back in the day, yeah, these days kids grow up, it takes a long time for kids to mature. But back then, let's just give an equivalent. Let's go back to, you know, medieval times. Kids had to grow up a lot faster back then. They mature a lot faster. So I struggled with this. But then somebody in the comments mentioned that they technically explained this in light novel. It just wasn't explained here. And again, that's where I go. Are a lot of my frustration with the story, which that was a huge one for me, I'm like, these kids are just acting stupid, honestly. Was it because they just didn't adapt it properly? And so all my frustrations, I think, are kind of aiming more towards the studio doing an improper job of the show more than the story itself, which I think has elements in it that were interesting to me. I don't think it's portrayed well enough. So I struggle with it. I really do. I don't think this is going to be something that's going to be corrected with the Blu-ray, honestly, unless they want to redo the entire series. I honestly don't think it's a series that's going to get another season, and that does bug me because technically they leave half of the story on a pretty much in the middle of a big battle. I struggle with the idea that I don't think it's going to get another season. I don't think it did well enough, and it does leave on a really nasty point. So I really struggle with even considering suggesting this show, especially right now without a second season, if they are going to announce a second season. It is technically one that Crunchyroll was a part of the production of it. So Crunchyroll might try to push for a second season. But then again, that's one of those things where how many other companies were involved, and are they going to be wanting to fork money for it, is a big question mark. And I honestly would tell Crunchyroll, get another studio. If they do another season, I don't want to see Emil Pinzi on there again. I really don't. I really think they should get, I don't care who, somebody besides them. Get Studio Dean's bad group. anybody besides Emil Pinzi. Because I think they, I don't want any more from them. So they ruined Berserk. Now they ruined this one. I don't want to see anything else from Emil Pinzi at this point. I enjoyed a lot of it. I loved our conversations regarding it, especially. I loved speculating on things with the community. I just think it's disappointing, especially because of the studio itself. So I should stop. That's my thoughts on Soma Spider So What. I don't like Mel Pinzi. I really don't right now. Osamake, rom-com where a childhood friend won't lose, or Asana Najimi ga Zetai ni Makanai love comedy. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Dogokobo. The source is a light novel. The genres are harem, comedy, romance, school. And this opens up with a guy named Suihara, who essentially is trying to get hooked up with this girl named Shirokusa. She is actually a well-known writer, and she's wrote some stuff that got her a lot of popularity. And he's essentially trying to confess with her. And you kind of find out that he's actually has a childhood friend named Kuroha. And Kuroha at some point apparently had confessed to him, but he rejected her. But she still kind of supports him. And this kind of builds up in this whole idea of him eventually. You kind of find out that he's actually a child actor. And he had some problems with his childhood that kind of led him to leave the acting business. And some people seemingly wanting to bring him back into it. And yeah, I don't really know what else to get into. Your thoughts on Osamake? Did I miss anything? He's just trying to get with this other girl. She rejects him. She rejected his childhood friend. Acting. Everybody seems to be a part of the acting world in some way, shape, or form. The school seems to be flooded with them. And yeah, there, it seems like they're trying to get him back into the business.
Yeah. I did really love this show. It was so goofy, so fun. A lot of weird, the funny thing is when I watched this show, I remember Andrew had brought up Game of Thrones at some point, and we know now that he was talking about Spider. But this one, as I was watching it, I was like, was he talking about this show as the Game of Thrones? Were people telling him that this was a Game of Thrones? Because the weird thing about this, and just bear with me, if you were to take Game of Thrones and make it into a anime high school rom-com, that would be this show. It did a lot of goofy things as far as characters were going behind each other's backs to see if they could capture Maru, and it was really, really goofy on a lot of that stuff. I'm not saying that it was absolutely mind-bending. It wasn't like I was sitting here going, what, who's doing what? It just the going behind each other's back type thing is all I'm talking about. But I did have a lot of fun with the show. A lot of the characters were fun. A lot of the there was a lot of goofy hijinks in between each one. I can't think of any characters that really kind of bugged me per se, but I had a lot of fun watching the show. I was constantly having fun, laughing. Yeah, just great show.
I really don't want to talk too much about this because I really didn't like the show at all. first of all, Dogokubo, I hope that everything's okay with that studio, because this was easily the worst visually and animated series they've ever done. And that's me really setting the bar high for Dogokubo. The thing that really kind of made Dogokubo become a studio that I take note of every season is because they have the knack for bringing, you know, typically cutesy shows and really giving it really high value of animation that really kind of brings the world itself and the characters to life. And this one didn't look good at all. And there was a lot of wonky character designs. They kept getting off model. It was very flat visually. Like, visually, it looked like the characters were very flat. And that could have just be a artistic choice they made for this show itself. So I'm not going to give that too much of a negative. It's just it didn't look very lively. It didn't look like the characters were alive. There was only a very brief few moments, like with Kuroha and Suihara in, you know, moments together that they really kind of put a little bit of effort into it. But overall, it just looked very flat and very unanimated. So that's my disappointment there, because I like I said, and that's me setting the bar high for Dogokubo. I love what they do. I love Dogokubo. It would be like us watching a football show and suddenly it looks like, I don't know, So Much Spider, So What. Not that bad. That's way too bad. That's way too bad of an example. but yeah, visuals aside, like I said, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I don't really see any value to me really kind of being overly critical of something. I don't see it. Obviously didn't work for me. I wanted it to work for me. I think my biggest disappointment was early on, and maybe that was, I'll admit that maybe it's an issue where I was disappointed early on and I could never really get into it after that. The big disappointment was in the fact that similar to Higahiro, Osamake has a very misleading title. Not as misleading, it's just it is misleading. It's not a lie, but it's misleading. And the idea that it says it's a rom-com where a childhood friend won't lose. So your initial thought is, oh, this is the story where Kuroha, who is the childhood friend, is not going to lose. But then I'm like, wait, I'm not going to be tricked here. Maybe her not losing is that she's going to help him. She's going to win by helping him get with the girl that he wants, which is this writer. And then you find out that pretty much everybody in this dang world apparently is a childhood friend to this character, because literally they've all seen him in his acting career and been a part of his life at some point as a child. And then it's like, okay, well then everybody, there's no point to this title anymore, because literally it's a rom-com where somebody is going to win. And that's literally all it means, because they're all childhood friends. And so it's that misleading that really kind of put a huge damper for me really early on. It's like, this isn't the, obviously everybody jokes about the fact that, and I'll accept it, Andrew likes his childhood friend characters. I really like that archetype. And so obviously, and especially the fact that I love Kuroha's voice actor, it's Hestia is one of the roles that she plays. I love her seiyuu. I love how forward Koroha is. I like that she is not the typical childhood friend where they wait too long before they act and they fail because of that. She's acted. She's already done it. She's tried to get his attention. She's already confessed. And so she's not already in those trappings. And so I like the idea of seeing that success for her. But it's just... I like a lot of the interactions. I think the overall story didn't work for me. A lot of the chemistry didn't work for me. The choices that the writer made with the characters frustrated me to no end. It feels like at some point, like after a few episodes, the writer just suddenly hated Koroha. And so he turned her character into just a garbage character that just annoys people. And then it just hyper focuses on another character. And in the end, as I'm going along watching this show, I'm like, the only character I could probably root for at this point is probably Maria. Like, Maria is the only character I can see that she doesn't have any real faults with her. That I'm not fresh. And then she ends up, like, later on doing something. And I'm like, girl, that's really mean that you think that way. Like, I'm going to be vague with this. There's a point in which this girl, which is technically the little sister character, who... as obviously, again, was in the movie industry with him. She chooses, they're making a video. And the way that, this could be a translation thing. The way they put it was that we're going to go talk about the situation about his late mother. And I'm a part of that. So that will give me the ability to sneak in when he's sorrowful. And I'm like, that was nasty. Like, that's really a nasty way of thinking about the situation. You're putting him in a very vulnerable position. It's like the guy going to a funeral to pick up girls. It's like that. It's like, this is wrong, honestly. And when it said that, and granted, they kind of try to save her later on in that. It's like, wow, are you trying to ruin the only character I can see, honestly, being decent in the show? Everybody's a liar. Everybody's manipulative. I'm not getting the comedy in that, unfortunately. It was a struggle for me, and honestly, and like I said, I really wanted to stick with it because Dogokobo, but I think, like I said, it's one of their lesser works. I don't know. I honestly can't really think of anything that really stood out as good with this series that I really wanted to really kind of pick apart. There was something I've already forgotten about it. I think it's probably just really kind of centered around the movie industry stuff. I think had some potential there of doing something interesting, really kind of around what Sugihara went through, the industry itself trying to take advantage of him, and them essentially trying to fight back against it was decent. But yeah, I don't know. It just didn't work for me, honestly. It'll work for other people. I was frustrated the entire time. I didn't like what they did with the characters. I'll just leave it at that and move on. That's my thoughts on Osamake. I made a funny joke on Twitter, by the way, with this one. Did I mention that to you? Like, they have this whole segment where they were trying to make commercials, and Maria is like, they're talking about the commercial that Maria made, and then she gets on the phone with Sugihara, and he's like, he's literally on the set as they're going to do the recording. And then literally that same night, because she's still in her same outfit, her sister's still in her same outfit, that night, somehow they record the commercial, record the band that they were doing the commercial with, edited it, put in special effects, because there's like some warping, crazy, psychotic special effects with him, uploaded it and posted it in that same, like, had to been within an hour. Like, wow, dang, this is impressive. They got some really good editors on that team. I don't know, maybe they were just recording the final scene, they just had to tack it on the end of it, who knows. Osamake, rom-com where childhood friend went loose, a title that should have been straight up Andrew's alley and did not deliver whatsoever, unfortunately. So the Slime Diaries. Tensura, Nikki, Tensai, Shitara, Slime, Dr. Ken, The Slime Diaries, a series on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by 8-Bit, source of manga. New thoughts? Or does anything have to be set up for this? It's like a short series?
Not really. It's just pretty much a spinoff. It goes to a certain point in the story. Now, this is written by the original creator, if I remember right. And I have to say this is...
Was it? I thought it was like they overseen it or something like that. No, I think it was. It's just somebody did the art. I don't remember. Sorry, continue. I'll look it up.
This is what's really nice about this show, and I don't really have much more to add from my first impressions because there's not much that's happened since then. It's literally the embodiment of if you were to take all of the high-pressure situations out of the slime show, if you take all that out and just have them do slice of life, that's what this show is. And it does that in spades, and I really, really love it for that. There's a lot of comedic moments. All of the more comedy central things involving each one of the characters, it's just taking those and using them in slice of life situations so it has more time to breathe. Shion and the demon lord girl, I can't think of her name off the top of my head, them going at it. Milam? And
Milam?
Milam, yeah. She's calling her one horn, and she says, "My name is Shion." And yeah, that's right. So, like I said, all the comedy bits that you have in the slime show is there. It's just more gives it more time to breathe. Kind of centralizes more on the kind of quote unquote human elements, which I say quote unquote because they're not technically humans, but go with what it is. So each one of the characters has just more time to chill and have fun and just live life as it is. One of the more interesting aspects is Slime is taking the stuff from his world and bringing it into their world. So like festivals, he's bringing those in, harvesting time, stuff like that. Christmas, he's bringing in. New Year's, he's bringing in. So a lot of that kind of cool stuff is getting brought into their world and how they're just using that and making it their own.
Yeah, it's different writer.
Is it?
Yeah. Cool stuff. Slime Diaries. Check that out. Mini Dragon, this is going to be a really quick one. It's a short, 1 minute long episodes. I think the intro to each episode is longer than the actual episode at times, but... Yeah, it's just a nice little kind of, you know, appetizer before we get, thankfully, a whole nother season of Maid Dragon here next season. But
and it's interesting that you put it that way because it is very true. It is an appetizer. All this did was make me want the show more.
I think that's what we said in the first impressions. Like the only thing I don't like about this Mini Dragon series is like the episodes end so quickly. I was like, no, I want more. Like Kana doing Kobayashi's hair. I love the Elma one where like they know what time it is based on when her belly growls because she just eats food so many times. I like that our girl Riko was given Quetzalcoatl some tips on what boys want. So wrong. It's like she's prying her to find out more about boys and what they want. Power outage with Fafnir. They did the MMO meetup. With Fafnir and all them. Everybody looked like completely different to their avatar except for him. They're like, I knew it was you based on how you look. They're all liars. It's just quite a lot of fun. Just love it to death. Really good. Really, really cute. Thankfully, we have another season coming. Otherwise, I'd probably be a lot more negative about this. If we didn't know that another season was coming, I'd be really, really negative. Like, no, it's just a tease. It's all it is. It's a tease. That's it for the new shows for this season. Really quickly, we can go through some of these mid-season, get our impressions on what's going on with these shows. First off is Tokyo Revengers. Essentially, for those that don't know, this is a series that pretty much follows a guy named Takemichi who finds out that his childhood girlfriend has been killed in a gang dispute. And he ends up, while he thinks that he's going to die falling in front of a train, he ends up transporting back in time. And back to when he was in high school. And essentially what kind of transpires is he, with the help of this girl's brother, they kind of work together to figure out a way of manipulating the past using this transportation method to essentially prevent this Tokyo Manji gang from really kind of building up and preventing essentially this dispute that would eventually happen that would cause the death of her. And the only problem with that whole process is that he has to do it back in time when he... Well, he's still a wuss in the future, but he's back in time. He's an absolute wuss. He cries all the time and has to fight against basically a bunch of gang members that are very rough and could kill him. So that's been in the gist of the series so far, is really just him jumping back, trying to change something, and then seeing if it possibly fixes things in the future. And sometimes it does, and it still ends up falling apart in the end. Very Steins Gate-y. But, yeah, I... First of all, really still dislike the fact that they are censoring the Manji symbol in this series. I will still stand by my argument that the censorship of that is just ignoring the fact that the swastika is literally just a perversion of that symbol, and it's not the symbol itself. The Manji symbol does have meaning to this group, and they have it on their jackets. It should be respected in that regard. But anyways, I've enjoyed... I'm back and forth on this show, really. I love the fact that he is very much a underdog, and he's fighting to save this girl that he obviously regains his love for. And so there is a lot of heart around the idea that he is struggling so much to save this girl when he's not a big buff dude. He's not strong. He's not capable. But he has heart, and he has desire to save her. But he's an absolute winebag, and after the 50th time of hearing him cry about situations, it's getting hard. Like, I definitely agree with a lot of people who comment and say this is basically Erased, but where the main character gets beat up and cries every episode. because that's at this point has become a struggle. At some point, you just desire for the underdog to finally have his moment of rising, and he just never does. He just still... is a winebag, and really the only way he's overcoming things is by really trying to pull people into the right positions to prevent stuff from happening. Not necessarily that he does anything. He has his moments, but for the most part, he's just an absolute annoying winebag. I like a lot of the cast. Mikey has been pretty cool. A lot of the other supporting characters have been fantastic. I love Hinata, the girl he's trying to save. And it has definitely a nice feel of that old... Yeah, biker gang style stuff that has been kind of obviously left behind in history. But yeah, I like it. I struggle with it. I hate Takemichi. I love the characters. I love the drama. I love the sense of tension sometimes. Like, there's a moment where Hinata slaps Mikey and it's like, oh crap, this is not good. Because obviously Mikey's a dangerous person. So it has that sense of danger. It has that sense of the underdog. Just obviously muddled a little bit by an annoying main character. Doesn't happen way too much. But yeah, Tokyo Revengers. Still watching it. I thought it was going to be a single core, but apparently it seems like it's still going on. I don't think they're going to tell us how many episodes it's going to be. 2 Year Eternity. This one is, of course, going to cores about halfway through at this point. Have you been catching up on this one?
I need to.
You need to. It's beautiful. I don't want to go too much into this because this series really kind of is about its reveal, and it's about the context of the story itself. So I don't want to reveal too much on it, but it essentially opens up with a object, this being that has been placed upon this planet by this beholder, and this being, this object is able to, when kind of gets connections to things around it, it's able to mimic it in some way. And it's about this object really kind of meeting people and gaining a sense of self and a sense of emotion and identity that is really the crux of the story. So it's kind of a traveling object that is able to encounter people and be kind of engaged with them to the point where it evolves, essentially. And that's really been the key focus, as he kind of meets this boy who's alone at this village out in the middle of this kind of snowy area. Eventually meeting this other little girl who is a part of this tribe that has this kind of sacrificial thing they do on a regular basis. And I think here the recent focus has been on Gugu, who works at this brewery place, and his history. A lot of that kind of stuff is kind of, again, forming and building up this object to be what it is. And that's a lot of the enjoyment. It is the heart of the stories around it that affects it, but also its kind of inclusion. It's his very alien nature being included in the situation. That's a lot of the draw. And this one, unlike Song of Spider, So What, this is an absolute phenomenal adaptation of this particular manga. I have read the manga. I'm pretty much a little bit ahead of where they're currently at. I'm looking forward to actually... This is funny because it's a manga that I actually got... I kind of grew away from, and I kind of just let it be. I didn't really keep up on it because I just kind of lost interest, I guess. Not really that it was bad. But this is one of those cases where as I'm watching this adaptation that Brainspace is doing with this series, I now want to go back and read the manga again because I'm getting reinvigorated by just how excellent they've actually adapted this. The animation, the music, the directing that they've done on the series is absolutely phenomenal. I cannot tell you how many times throughout watching this where I just got goosebumps. Like, they did this scene so perfect. Like, it's kind of like Attack on Titan for me with the adaptation. It transcends the original work. Unlike where most cases you're like, go read the source material. This is one of those ones like, no, watch the show. Like, they've respected this story so well by what they've done so far with it. I cannot express enough. Watch this series. It is absolutely beautiful. It's beautifully done. The music's fantastic. The stories themselves have so much heart. Because, like I said, it's so great how they portray, and again, this is another thing of the adaptation doing a phenomenal job, the way they portray this being that is on this planet is very alien. Like, he doesn't respond to things properly. He's just a blank slate, basically. And as it's walking around these people and gaining experience that these very human experiences from these people around him that are very, you know, they're difficult struggles. Like, with March, which is the second person that he technically runs into, she's basically given up by her entire village to be a sacrifice. And you have that sense of these people kind of being conflicted by it, but they have to go with it because it's their tradition. This is what they have to do. All that stuff is, like I said, very human, very traumatic experiences that he's essentially onlooking to. And like I said, all those stories are, at least from what I've read so far, have been fantastic. I still haven't finished Gugu's story, which is technically, I think they have adapted at this point. And I am really looking forward to Gugu's story because I technically, with the manga, Gugu's story was the one that got me. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the conclusion of it. But even with the March story, like I said, I knew what the story was. And I wasn't too impressed in the manga when I read it. Like, it was good. I enjoyed it. But it wasn't until I seen it adapted, I'm like, holy crap, this took it to another level. Like, they did so good on this. So, yeah. Highly recommend it. It's one of those things, like, it's mid-season, so as always, it's hard for us to recommend things because we don't know where it's going to pan out, and literally, I don't know what the story is going to be that it's eventually going to get into because I haven't read that far in the manga, so far, it's doing a phenomenal job, so. How are we doing on Welcome to Demon Skull Irmakun, second season? We
caught up.
Solid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very much enjoying it. I thought you were going to do your thing on it.
I think it's something about a boy getting sold to a demon guy by his family who's a bunch of jerks, and
yeah,
him having to act like a demon in a demon school.
Yeah, and in this season, so far we have gotten Amelie in kind of a shoujo-esque style, and it was really funny, goofy to have that. Iruma had kind of a evil phase per se, and that was really, really funny. I think they did really well at that, and that how he was just basically making all the demons go crazy over him because him acting as a demon threw everybody off. So that was goofy and fun. Opened up some kind of weird, strange things that they have in the school. So that was kind of cool. Introducing another teacher, kind of getting a little bit of background behind Iruma's homeroom teacher. So, and then now we're going into the next season. Lots of fun, goofy, just a weird, like I said before, it's not the greatest shonen in the world, but it's something that's different and refreshing on that respect. And that's why I kind of like it, and it works really well for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And last one is, I think it's the last one, yeah. My Hero Academia Season 5. I've dropped off the last couple episodes, so I don't know how much. Well, I think you watched ahead of me, but...
No, I stopped it around the same time as you.
I haven't watched the 100th episode. I watched 99.
Yeah, I'm behind on 2 episodes right now. So.
It showed that the 100th was watched. You didn't watch the 100th episode?
Okay, then maybe I did watch
it. It was like the Christmas episode. One or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one.
And then, but at some point you mentioned something about arcs and stuff like that, and I said that I need to go and research it, find out what's going on in it.
Yeah, that's my problem right
now.
So,
we're
like,
at
we did the tournament. So, the tournament. Do you like the tournament? I don't like tournaments, obviously. I always didn't mention that. Again, this is one of those ones where I didn't like the tournament. Mainly, my frustration with this tournament was... is that I felt like it made so many characters... I get downplayed them. Like, there was so many characters that are we've seen as being really solid just get downplayed so bad here. Like, the one that I remember off the top of my head was Red Riot. Like, he got so downplayed in their match. It's like, that's not Red Riot. Red Riot's not that weak. Why did they just kind of... it's time for this character to shine right now. So, Red Riot, you need to go off to the side and be weak right now. That was my frustration. It's like, now granted, there was a couple of them that I'm like, Bakugo's phenomenal. Like, Bakugo's tournament was phenomenal, or his match. That really showed me how much Bakugo grew, how much he is better at being a team player, I guess, and how much Deku is so behind. Like, this gave Deku a reason to keep pushing forward, is how much... they showed Bakugo basically grow up. He's way far ahead now. But do the rest of them, like I said, I was really frustrated with the rest of the fights.
Do you think it was more along the lines of characters getting downplayed? Or do you think it's more a matter of characters that you're not seeing being brought up?
I'm saying they wanted to bring the other ones up, so they downplayed them.
I don't think
so. I felt like they went, Red Riot, you need to be over here and be weak right now because it's this character's time to shine.
You're focusing on Red Riot.
No, I'm just giving him an example.
I know. That's what I'm trying to say is...
it's illogical that he would be knocked out that easy.
What I'm saying is a lot of these other characters, like you were saying, Bakugo, I'm also taking into consideration the Class B. They were brought up to almost the same level as Class A. That's my point, is that some of these other characters that you're not really paying attention to most of the time are being brought up. Not necessarily that the other characters are being downplayed, that the other ones are being brought up. That's my point. Because I thought that it was very interesting to see a lot of these other characters that I've never cared to see, didn't think much of them. I just knew that they were in the school with them.
A good example of my frustration. Okay, so... when they had, I always forget his name every time I go to talk about him, Mr. Engine Feet, because I really don't like him. Mr. Engine Feet, in his match, this is an example of why it seems illogical how they're dismissed. In his match, he is going to flee with somebody else to get out of a situation. And what happens? After he leaves... this other character crawls to a building and pushes it over, and it lands on him. How?
I agreed with you when you said that.
The dude can go 3 blocks in about 2 seconds if he's going his slowest. But yet they're trying to push these other characters down to make other ones rise and give them attention. That's my point. It's they're downplaying the abilities of these characters to make these characters shine. I don't mind these characters shining. Just make these ones go out of the way for a second while you let them shine. Don't downplay them to make these ones shine. That was my frustration. That's what I just gave Red Riot as an example because he gets knocked out in one shot. So that's my frustration. But other than that, like I said, I they had a lot of really fantastic moments. Like Deku kind of evolving what he's able to do was interesting. I like to see where they're going to do with that. Getting some, again, like I said, I don't mind those moments that those characters got to shine, because I got to see some really fantastic character moments with these characters finally shining. But I guess my argument of B being able to kind of be upplayed, my only argument there is, what would be the reason why you'd want to give them a moment to shine?
I'm thinking that maybe they're going to be more prominent in the future.
Would they?
Possible. I don't
would
know.
Would they? That's the problem is, does the B...
I'm guessing at this point.
B doesn't
I don't know.
Have... They didn't have B get their license, did they?
No. Not that I know of.
So what would be the point in them being able to shine, because they can't necessarily do anything?
You're at the same spot as me. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I'm looking...
My only point...
Maybe that, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know.
The benefit there really is, yeah, technically it does make them realize they need to progress more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, one of the ones that come to my mind really was Tokoyami. He had a really big awakening there that I'm not as... I need to work harder. Like, he technically let his guard down, technically, but it does... Yeah, and Red Riot had the same mentality, as it makes him realize that he needs to step up. He's not... They progress further. Keep stretching. I mean, that was the thing with Deku. Is he's seen Bakugo this much further ahead of him. He needs to get better. There's a constant goal that you need to keep pushing towards. So there's an argument to be made there, and I honestly agree with that, but... Yeah, what was his name? The mind control guy. They did a lot with him. I like his little bond with Eraserhead. I thought it was pretty cool that Eraserhead kind of brought him under his wing and was training him. But yeah, the elephant in the room obviously is going to be what's going to be happening next, because I've heard a lot of discussions that they're temporarily skipping the next arc, and that's what the 100th episode apparently showed. That concerns me. I know the studio is probably not going to screw things up. They obviously have a big deal here. I assume it's because they can't do this arc within a single core, and we only have another core to go with the season. So I'm assuming that they probably went, okay, well, we can't complete this new arc that's coming up next within these 12 or so episodes. So let's either do it the next season and let's do this other arc first, and then next season we'll open up with that arc, or they're going to make a separate offshoot series that's going to be covering just that arc. Call it, what was it, the Villain Academia or whatever. That's the struggle. I'm the same boat. It's like, I haven't touched the 100th episode because I'm like, should I just read the manga? Do I need to go read the manga? I don't know. I kind of hoping that they'll announce, hey, yeah, here, it's going to be next season. It's going to be that arc. And then I'll be like, eh, okay, well, I'll trust you that you... But they're saying that I've seen too many people say that you literally can't tell this arc they're adapting without having the context of that. And that's what frustrates me. That's what I struggle with. But again, I kind of fall back to the idea of, I hope that I would assume they're not going to screw it up. And assume they know what they're doing, but... That's Hiro Aka. Had a nice little Achiko moment. Gravity is still best girl. I think that she shined really well in that season too. They had a moment and that stupid idiot decided to interrupt it. Broke my heart. Yep. That's it. That's it for spring. We're done. And you can finally start getting started on the next season. Once I record my last, I think I have like 5 more review videos to record, and then I have this to edit, and then we'll be done with spring. But yeah, we hope you guys enjoyed this spring 2021 anime season reviews. As always, we appreciate everybody for their support, both verbally by telling other people about us and then supporting us through Patreon. We have all of our links on otakuspirit.com on the right side there. You can go there and get our links to our podcast, our YouTube channel, Patreon, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we hope you guys enjoyed, as always, and we look forward to talking about summer. Exciting. Ready?
Already started.
Yeah, I know. I already watched one show, but that was about it. No, 2 shows. I watched Peach Boy and...
I did Peach Boy, The Realist Rebuilds a Kingdom, Villainous.
I watched Peach Boy and one other one,
I think.
Yeah,
Peach Boy, I'm not sure.
I was like, yeah, that's going to be a little rough for you. No, what annoyed me about that one is it kind of like that Taboo Tattoo thing where they have this, you know, this character that kills a bunch of people, like innocent kids, and it's like, oh, they're going to make her into Goodbye. That's Taboo Tattoo did that, and I got annoyed. But anyways, that's for first impressions for that season. Thank you all for watching. Y'all take care.
Oss.